You know, twin siblings often enable and abet. While I never examined Nick or his sister, they both seem very, very close.
It's twincest.
Disturbingly close, Lauren.
Yours, mine, theirs.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast, Yours, Mine, and Theirs. My name is John, and not that it's any of your business, but I ate my own twin in utero. Who else is here?
Hey, this is Roy Sense, and I finger-painted this beautiful picture of my dream gone girl.
Oh, nice. Okay, now, other guests, you're going to have to fight to see who goes first.
Okay, we're going to do oldest. This is Sean, and I'm ready to do the Asian shimmy all over this book.
Okay, and this is Tony, and I just walked through a sugar storm unkissed.
This is Yours, Mine, and Theirs. Thank you, everybody. This time we're talking about twin movies. And before I forget, it's the best thing about this podcast is when we pick a category and we come up with three different movies such as these. I think this could be the differentest set of just one-by-one movies, the three set of movies that we watched, because we watched The Young Girls of Rochefort, the French movie about twins, and we watched Return of the Jedi, that turns out it's about twins, but they didn't know that when they started the series, right? And then we watched Gone Girl, and I was really skeptical about, you know, any twins being in this movie until they finally mention it on, you know, within the movie on TV and about how they're twins and how weird that is.
So also, like, there's extreme whiplash from the last podcast to this one.
Yeah. Right. And right. So because, yeah. So there are hardly any people shooting aliens with guns in these. But no, well, no, actually, except for one movie, there's a lot of alien shooting. Okay. Yeah. But big whiplash.
And I almost feel like every movie has a different theme. Every movie obviously has a different plot. Mm-hmm. Every movie has different wild moments and. Yet, the only thing that makes them similar are the twins.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. I think it's funny, and I'm gonna probably reemphasize this when we get to rankings. I think we always like stress out about where we rank them movies according to each other. But in this case, it's almost absurdly funny that we're like, okay, like, which movie do you like more, Return of the Jedi or The Young Girls of Rochefort? It's like that those shouldn't be in the same sentence, but I'm kind of delighted that they are. So, okay, so I don't know. We can talk about them. I don't know. Has anything happened in the last couple of weeks that we need to discuss before we go any further?
Since we're talking twins movies, yeah. All of us have seen Malignant, right?
No.
I was going to bring this up myself.
All right, so. You guys go ahead.
Wait, John, you haven't?
I haven't seen Malignant.
Oh!
Okay, well, I don't want to spoil for you, but...
Why did I see Malignant?
So, it's a twins movie.
Uh-huh.
But it was great, and it was like, I don't know what you guys thought. I think you both liked it, but it takes this wild gamble. And it just pays off like really well, and it I haven't like seen a horror movie that has this kind of, I guess, villain in a really long time. But I really liked it.
And it's almost just like a plot line where you just have to go with it and not ask too many questions. Just let it happen, and you can enjoy it. You can laugh at it. You can. Do whatever you want, but in the moment, just enjoy it. Because I had a smile on my face for probably the last 45 minutes of that movie.
Oh, it's great. Because you reach a point where you're like, okay, I this is where we're going. I know where we're going. But you have no idea where it's going. And then when you see where it's going, it's just nuts. But it's great.
Yeah, I had the Tim Curry smile from, from Home Alone.
Well, similar to Eyes of Tammy Faye? Because that's the movie I saw.
Was it scary?
It kind of was. It was a little bit scary. I was afraid, like all the televangelists, that they could do that many things to each other behind the scenes. That was scary.
I will say Malignant is definitely going to get a sequel. It sets it up at the end, and it's probably going to do pretty well. So Which might not be a bad thing, but this was a pretty, it was pretty fun. It was a fun movie. I'm excited to go see Halloween Kills. I think that comes out next week.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I had tickets this Saturday for my local theater was doing a double feature of 1931 Dracula and 1931 Frankenstein.
Oh. Wow.
I bought tickets and then I sold them back because my wife asked me if I was going to go see those movies instead of watching conference. And it wasn't really a question. So
I would have gone. You could have.
We know what was deep in your heart, but you saved face and decided not to sleep on the couch after watching Bella.
Oh man!
Yeah. Don't worry, we know your real religion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it would have been super cool, but I'll go back to the theater and watch lots of rated R movies to make up for it. So.
Nice. Way to go.
Yeah.
Way to go.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm just tickled pink that the two young men who brought us Predator and Aliens last time are now forced to discuss what I consider a very delightful French musical, The Young Girls of Rochefort. And I'm just wondering, you know, considering the only thing I know about you guys is that you really like Predator and Aliens and Batman Returns, just how well did The Young Girls of Rochefort, like, hit your eyes? Like, did it translate at all for you guys?
So, for me, going into it, I thought I knew what I was getting into because I haven't really experienced that many musicals in my life. It's just never really been my thing, but I obviously saw La La Land and liked that, and then could see a lot of similarities in terms of like the way it looks, like the way the film looks to me, more so than that's what I enjoyed most about it, was just the looks and the colors and the pastels, as opposed to maybe, you know, it being in French. Isn't that big of a deal to me, but I was talking a little bit before I had to kind of stop and pause and make sure that I knew exactly who was going after who, because there was a few times where I was confused as to like, okay, wait, who is this guy? This carny wants who?
Any movie where you could ask that question is a good movie.
Is the mother after who? Like, it was, so I had to pause, rewind, but surprisingly, it was, I could appreciate it for what it was. I appreciated it. There was definitely time to bleed, and time did bleed a little, but unlike Predator, but I can find the appreciation in it.
So it's funny that you mentioned La La Land, because the director of La La Land says he was inspired by this film.
Like the opening sequence when they're just like, they're on the moving bridge thing. That was the beginning of La La Land. That was when they were dancing in the traffic jam at the beginning of La La Land. I thought it was really, really similar. I thought it was interesting.
Also, so I had previously seen the Jacques Demy, Catherine Deneuve movie, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. And I'll just say I like this one a lot more.
Right. But I think I saw similar. The beginning of Umbrellas of Cherbourg, where, because isn't it like a little bit almost like a documentary musical, sort of? Like, I feel like Umbrellas of Cherbourg, they're like kind of making up the songs as they go.
That's exactly what's happening. No one has any songs for that musical. They're just like singing. It's like from Elf. I'm singing the words. So, but anyway, there's plenty to talk about. But if you guys want to do your best to sum this up in a couple minutes.
Yeah, a couple minutes. Sum it up. Who dies?
I'll go here and give it my shot here. Okay, so the story revolves around twin sisters, Delphine and Solange, who each is looking for love and a way out of Rochefort. Then one day the fair comes and they meet two carnies, Etienne and Bill. And the twins' mother, I think her name is Yvonne, runs a cafe, and she longs for apparently the twins' father, whom she left She left him because of his last name, which is something we can dive into later. The Carnies are preparing to put on a show for the town, but their star dancers abscond with some random sailors. So the Carnies ask Delphine and Solange to perform in their stead, offering them a free ride to Paris in exchange for their dancing prowess. And then this is where all hell breaks loose. After the fair, each character is in a mad dash to find their love interest before they depart for Paris. And Solange, as things play out, Solange catches up with Gene Kelly. And after they kiss and dance, she no longer cares to leave Roquefort, apparently. And sick of waiting, after that happens, after they've done the dance, and sick of sitting and waiting, there's a chorus line of U-Hauls, or whatever they were back then, that is set to take the Carnies and Delphine off to Paris. And they leave. They don't wait around. They can't wait anymore, so they leave. And Delphine is sad because it appears she has missed out on her chance for love. There's a man, Maxence, I think is his name, and he frequents the cafe, and she's all a flutter for him, and so just when all hope seems lost, as the U-Hauls are pulling away, who is on the side of the road thumbing for a ride but Maxence himself? He gleefully climbs aboard the caravan, and in late 60s cinematic fashion, we fade out to blue.
And Yvonne runs into Mr. Dame.
Yes.
Right? And they've been only three stores away from each other for 20 years.
Yeah.
So, but they finally run into each other because they're both picking up Yvonne's kid, Boo Boo.
Boo Boo. Yeah. Picking up Boo Boo. And so then, yes, if Yvonne finds her love as well. Only, as you said, they were two blocks away, two stores down from each other, and didn't know they were there. But that is the beauty of Paris in the late 60s.
Yeah.
Magic.
It's so interesting that they never crossed paths.
So I want to
hold on.
I want to talk about it. Yeah, because it's crazy, okay? So I'm sorry. I apologize for interrupting. But okay, there's some things here. So Yvonne never told her daughters the name of their father, Mr. Dame, right? She must never have mentioned that because Solange has been taking music lessons from Mr. Dame for a while. And Mr. Dame apparently has told her about Yvonne, but without mentioning the name ever.
Right.
And Mr. Dame never left his store, or Yvonne never left her store, because they would have run into each other. But then the other thing is Maxence lives at the cafe. And he's never seen Delphine, who is Yvonne's daughter, who is also always at the cafe, except when Maxence is there.
So Delphine, she's a lazy cafe person. She doesn't help at the cafe at all. Like, because Yvonne had to get that other hot French girl to wait at the cafe, even though she has two perfectly capable young daughters. Well, okay, here's one thing. Okay, this is bugging me for a few minutes, and this is a minor thing, but it may help explain a few things. We got to keep in mind that Mr. Dame is not the twins' father. We have no idea who the twins' father is. Dame is Boo Boo's father. Mr. Dame was, when he was dating Yvonne, he said she mentioned the twins that she kind of kept hidden from him. He's like, I never met the twins that, you know, of this girl that I was engaged to. But I don't think he was aware that he was Boo Boo's father. So the twins' father is not in the movie.
Okay, so that's a good catch, because I was going to, as one of my incest moments, I was going to have Mr. Dame was like kind of in love with Solange, and I thought, you know, eventually he's going to find out that's his daughter.
It was a lot like the Mr. Burns, so he was dating that one woman, and then he saw her 20 years later. And then, but I look past her age to her daughter.
Okay, so also, like, it snuck into this plot in the weirdest way ever, is that one of their good friends who constantly frequents the cafe has been cutting people up and packing them into suitcases, right?
Yes, there is a strange murder plot. And, you know, that's the thing about the French. And if you remember right, I thought about this, like, when the... that Hebdo, Charlie Hebdo, was bombed by the terrorists a few years ago. And, you know, all of us Americans were like, our thoughts and prayers go out to you in France. And, like, a few of them were like, we don't believe in God. We believe in dancing and singing. That's how we celebrate. And that's what I was kind of thinking when I was like there's a serial killer in their inner circle, but they were dancing and singing because it like meant nothing to them, because nothing could overcome the dancing and singing of this movie. Not even a serial killer.
Oh man. The great thing about this film, of course, is all the color, right? And I think Umbrellas of Cherbourg, it's even more explicit. It's just like, it's like Homer uses the makeup gun on the screen, right? But there's just so much bright color, and it's sad because the last couple times the last time I went to Europe, the people over there are mostly still wearing like grays and blacks, and that's kind of still fashionable, right, as monochromes. But how fun and liberating would it be to just say, I'm going out today wearing this completely green outfit, or just a crazy color. And so like the outfits they wear in this show are just, I love them. I love it. Lots of color.
Yeah.
Oh, being able to wear anything, without having, being looked down upon, almost like in Seinfeld when George wants to drape himself in velvet, it was socially acceptable, would be, you know, enriching in a way.
Yeah.
But they all look good though, didn't they?
No, man. I mean, they still look
good. Yeah, I thought they did, yes.
Like, so you have the carnies who always wear, like, the ties that are just, like, the perfect off shade from the shirt they're wearing. Like, I guess they had to buy their shirts and ties together for all their outfits.
I feel like carny is a much more noble profession in France than the United States, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. And I was going to bring this up. You hear about a carny now, you don't think of those two carnies from this film.
No.
No.
No, think of like like 5'4", 3 teeth, goblin fingers, and these guys looked like they were straight out of GQ, and not only that, they had the two, like the two beautiful women in the town just falling over themselves for the carnies, where if you were to announce if you came rolling into a town and announced that you were a carny, I don't know that you'd be able to pick up a woman at a truck stop.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you'd have to have a bucket of caramel.
Was anybody else? I might be the only one. I was the only one in my household anyway. But was anybody else kind of rooting for the carnies to get the girls? Like, because the girls, it was established at the beginning of the movie, Delphine is like, oh, this guy painted a picture of me like a weird stalker. I'm in love with him. And then, you know, Solange is like, okay, well, you know, there's this really creepy composer from America that I bumped into. I'm in love with him. I felt like they needed to get with the carnies. They needed to start their lives over and rethink their lives and go off to Paris, you know, in an adventure with the carnies. But that's totally not what happened. I was hoping at least one of them would, but it's sort of implied at the end that Delphine does come, like, meet up with the psycho poet.
So,
yeah.
No,
I was just going to say that I feel like if they were looking for, you know, a way out of Roquefort and to experience life, it was going to be much more exciting to go with the carnies. And at least, I mean, if you're not going to get married, you know, then at least have a good time, have some excitement. You know, those carnies are doing all sorts of stuff. Whereas, yeah, that poet, he's just going to be, I mean, he's going to be sitting inside pining and writing, and he's going to be stuck cooking him meals and batting away bugs with a wooden spoon and a boot.
So Solange is at least going to have fun, right? Because like the guy, like Gene Kelly is into music. She's into music, but Delphine and Maxence, I think you'd get tired of after 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He just seems like a Morrissey fan kind of.
So also, because Maxence is in the Navy, and every musical I've ever seen that takes place in France. There's just naval people everywhere. And so in France, do you have to join the Navy for a couple years? Do they have like a mandatory military thing? And if so, is your job to do nothing but to like walk around Paris and provide ambiance? And
that does make sense, actually. It's like, yeah, we established something with our French musical, so we're gonna have to conscript a lot of young men to wander around Paris for the vibe, you know, for the tourism. Yeah.
Well, I mean, do you guys have anything more you want to talk about with this film?
Okay, I will say this. I mean, we're going to get to this when we talk about, like, rankings and how much we liked it and the awards and everything. But I watched this movie with Katie, and, like, right from the first few seconds, she just lit up. She lit up. And I think there's something about the color and the MGM musicalness of it, because as you say, this is after the Umbrellas of Cherbourg, where it's like, okay, there is something a little bit magical meeting across the Atlantic, because it's like the technicolor of the United States and the musical sensibility of the United States, but then the setting and language of France and French that kind of makes a pretty good alchemy. I'll just say that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it was good. And so it took me a second to recognize Gene Kelly, but I think he's pretty old in this film, but I think he still looks great, and he does great, and he's got the Gene Kelly smile. So what's her name?
I really liked his wardrobe in this. I know we talked about colors, but he had that crushed velvet purple top with those white pants. I gotta say, to be able to rock that, I think Gene was just class all the way.
and I will say, there was something about the characters dreaming of something more and almost putting that out into the, you know, out into the world, and then having that come to life, and each character walks away happy at the end, and ultimately what they want out of life happened. So there's something special to be said about that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a delightful musical, right? There's nothing too heavy in it, and everyone gets what they want in the end, and there's lots of dancing, and there's lots of singing, and it's pretty to look at. So Catherine Deneuve, is that how you say her name? I have no idea.
I think so.
She did this movie the exact same year that she did Belle de Jour, which is really different film. It's definitely not a G-rated musical.
Time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it the disturbing aspect of French culture, Belle de Jour?
Well, it's okay. So the plot, like, is that this girl, her love life is, she doesn't understand why she can't love her husband as much as she wants to, and then she finds that the best way to be able to love her husband is to, during the day while he's at work, to be a prostitute at a cat house. And so those are the two movies she made that year. So,
well, I am going to watch it. I, for one, feel that I'm a huge fan of Catherine Deneuve. I believe she's still with us. I think she's had, like...
She is. She has a movie coming out this year.
Oh, wow.
Thank
like
you, Deneuve.
She's, like, 78 years old now.
Good for the Deneuve. Yeah.
But, like, so somehow, completely accidentally, I've now watched four of her films. I've seen Repulsion. Have you guys seen Repulsion?
Oh, it's on my list.
No.
That's
a Roman Polanski kind of a horror film, right? And it's in English, so that's the good news. But she's the main person in that, and that is a weird film. Anyway, it's worth a watch. It's a good watch. But Catherine, she's kind of all over the place with her movies.
I think it's best when Deneuve is in a movie to just sit back and let her cook.
So we should also mention the character who owns the portrait gallery, right? Who I thought was going to be the murderer throughout the whole film,
right? Because he the gun-toting artist.
Yeah,
the brooding artist who because he was dating Catherine Deneuve, and she's like, you know, you just what does she say to him? She's like, you're really dour and old, and have a gun, so we're through. I like that guy. I thought he was pretty good and pretty honest, even though I believe he knew exactly where Maxence was the entire time, but I guess he kept that from her. But, I mean, come on. Can you blame him? He just lost out Catherine Deneuve.
Yeah.
He's going to kill himself after the movie's over, I'm sure.
I love that in the two podcasts just that we started this one and the last one, our affinity for men who just brood. The brooding man, you can always root for the brooder.
Yeah, is that museum guy, he's going to become French Batman probably.
He'll be wearing some kind of cowl. A cape probably too, no doubt about that.
So did you guys ever watch the cartoon The Tick?
Yes.
I never did.
Oh, that cartoon was so good. Who are the French superheroes they work with? It's like Eclair,
yeah. Oh, I remember that the Tick would come on a Nickelodeon late at night when I was a kid before my parents had okayed the Nickelodeon. So I was I would check into the Tick when possible.
Oh, that show was pretty good.
It was.
I remember the French people in the Tick. Dang it! I do remember Chairface Chippendale.
Chairface Chippendale, who
far on this. He wrote his name on the moon.
Wrote half of his name on the moon, yep.
Yeah. Huh.
All right.
Okay. All right. I think, I have a lot of awards for the young girls, so we can move on if you guys are ready.
We can move Yvonne.
We can move Yvonne.
All right.
Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, so even though I was forced to watch the special edition because that's what was available, I'm going to be talking about it as though it's the theatrical cut. Do I have to, do I need to remind anyone what happened in Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back? This is the last movie of this trilogy. I'm assuming everyone has seen those movies, so...
This is the first Star Wars movie I've ever seen.
Is it? Oh, well, then, John, I'm just going to give you a quick recap of the first two. And we have Luke Skywalker, who learns that he has Force powers because he's the son of Anakin Skywalker. He is enlisted to help Princess Leia, and they have plans to destroy the Death Star, which is owned by the Empire. And Luke destroys the Death Star using his budding Force powers. And The Empire Strikes Back, his training continues, but he interrupts his training in order to go save his friends from the clutches of the evil Darth Vader. And at the end of the film, John, we learn, as he's fighting Darth Vader and losing to Darth Vader, that Darth Vader is his father. And that is where we're at the beginning of The Return of the Jedi.
You did that really well, actually. I did not expect you to sum up the first two Star Wars movies in 10 seconds.
So, Return of the Jedi. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
John, really fast, is this really the first Star Wars movie you've ever seen?
I'm glad I was that convincing, but no. Star Wars, thousands of times. Truth. Yeah.
So I don't want to speak for John, but I'm pretty sure The Empire Strikes Back is your second favorite movie of all time.
It's top three, I think, for sure. Empire Strikes Back is, yeah.
All right.
Before you get into your summary,
sure.
I do just want to say that prior to the new films coming out, you know, the new trilogy, I had never seen Star Wars.
That's really impressive. I'm not even mad. I'm impressed.
So I only watched the first six in order to prep for the seven.
Okay, so that's an interesting perspective then. So watching the first six around the same time, do you have feelings towards the prequel trilogy versus the original trilogy? Because I think people have an enormous amount of anchoring bias with Star Wars movies because of, you know, nostalgia from their childhood. But you don't have that, so you're a good test case. So how do those first six movies really stack up to you?
Okay, so I obviously started with A New Hope. I watched them, obviously, in 4, 5, 6, then 1, 2, and 3. And I obviously didn't have... They didn't resonate with me as much as they would have if I would have grown up watching them. I mean, I did enjoy them for what they were. However, I obviously already knew, you know, that Darth Vader was Luke's father, and I already knew that they were twins. And so, like, I already had those. Obviously, that doesn't break the movie or anything like that. But I did find 4, 5, and 6 to be not as campy as those first three. Mm-hmm. While you can see that the CGI and the CG had gotten much better, you can still see just how campy the episode 1, 2, and 3 are. And there is still just a drastic change in voice from episode 4, 5, and 6 to episodes 1, 2, and 3. It's as almost as if they were made by two completely different people.
Yeah.
My honest take on it.
Yeah, so 1, 2, and 3 are all directed by Lucas, right? And then he only directed 4, so 5 and 6 have different directors, so I think you get a little bit of a different feel. So that's interesting. So I'm also curious, like, I assume you've seen Rogue One. Now, what do you think of Rogue One?
Rogue One is awesome.
I love Rogue One. I love it so much.
Huh. Yeah, it's
Rogue One is awesome.
Yeah, that's a great
especially
film.
Especially having bridging the gap between there and episode 4 was just awesome. And obviously getting to see Darth Vader at the very end was just fantastic for me.
Yeah, yeah, I really enjoyed Rogue One.
And
yeah,
so,
it's all right.
And so that comes to the next thing that I would like to say is
okay.
That Return, or no, I'm sorry, The Last Jedi is by far my favorite. And I know a lot of diehard Star Wars fans do not like it.
Because they're idiots.
That's true. The Last Jedi, like, I don't like the third trilogy, but The Last Jedi is the best Star Wars movie since 1980. It's the only one, and we're going to talk about a few things that I think make the first trilogy really great, a few things that kind of made me think as a kid, and The Last Jedi kind of brought a spark back, not so much in terms of special effects, not so much in terms of, you know, just like the spectacle and the, you know, CG and all that, but a little bit more in terms of an emotion and family and morality and, you know, stuff that, like, made me question a few things as a kid when I was watching the original Star Wars movies. It kind of made me think of those same things a little bit sideways, and I think Rian Johnson does a really good job of doing that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my thing on The Last Jedi.
So, and also, I mean, The Last Jedi, I love it because, again, it's like, it's like a movie about these people, like, and it's in a confined sort of setting, right? And so you have, again, a small group of people to care about, whereas the what's the final one called? Rise of Skywalker.
Oh.
All of a sudden, it's huge again, right? And it's all these worlds and it's all these people. But the second one, the Last Jedi, is intimate again, and that's why it kind of reminds me of The Empire Strikes Back. But then my favorite thing that ever happened in any of the Star Wars films was in The Last Jedi, where Rian Johnson tells us that anyone can have the Force. You don't have to have royal Force parents to have the Force. Anyone can have it. And then J.J. Abrams, man, just decided to retcon the crap out of that.
Some people are more than others. They're born that way.
Yeah. It's really hard when you write a script from Reddit rather than just writing it with, like, an original idea in mind. Or also when you don't have a clear idea of a full trilogy and you just write it movie by movie.
So does that seem Does that seem crazy to you? I know that Disney wanted to give three directors like, hey, have fun and we'll kind of keep it together. But it seems crazy that like a team didn't get together and say, okay, we need to hammer out a basic plot for this trilogy and then creative license within, right? And that didn't happen at all. It was just like a movie by movie. It's like, hey, Ryan, you saw The Force Awakens, so go for it, right?
Yeah. I think it is crazy, but it's not, like, unprecedented. Because, you know, behind-the-scenes stuff, like, some of the best stuff about the original trilogy was them just making stuff up on the fly. It's, like, one of those things that seems, like, etched in stone and eternal. This is some eternal story. But it's, like, the first trilogy, that was the eternal story. That's the thing he worked on for 20 years. But the original Star Wars movies, it was a case of them just kind of being like, oh, you know what? Okay, yeah, they are twins. Oh, you know what? Darth Vader is my father, you know. Those were, I don't care what anybody says, those are spur-of-the-moment ideas.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. And so I think they just thought that lightning would strike twice. Oh, and, like, another thing, like, you see this in TV, too. It's, like, kind of a funny thing. You see it in good and bad. JR, remember when we talked about Star Trek, you know, the cliffhanger with the Borg where Captain Picard has been captured by the Borg and Riker says fire and, oh, my gosh, they're going to kill Captain Picard. We have a season, you know, a summer, you know, it was a season break, and then we wait 3 months to find out what happens. And then it turns out, oh, a bunch of garbage happens because the writers were so proud that they wrote themselves into a corner. They're like, we're going to write ourselves into a corner, so then we have to think of something later. And then we're like, okay, well, yeah, it's obvious. It kind of sucked. But you know what else did that? Breaking Bad did that. Pretty much every season of Breaking Bad, they're like, we have no idea what the next season is going to be, and so we're going to have to think our way out of it. And they did, and they did it really, really well. And in that case, it worked. So I don't know what to say. Sometimes it works, and sometimes it fails miserably.
So then I guess with the Star Wars sequel trilogy, the final trilogy, what then should have happened if Disney really was going to say, okay, the challenge is to build off the story from the last movie, is that J.J. Abrams should have been willing to stick to it and go with that plot point, right?
Yes. Yes. But I don't know. I guess that's when the Reddit thing comes in because, you know, so many people complained.
So many.
And they shouldn't have. You know, they should have given it, like, I don't know, been like me and taken like a week to think about The Last Jedi and why it's good rather than just impulse. Because, you know, I'll tell you what, you know, when I watched The Last Jedi, I wasn't super impressed. It wasn't until it just kind of sat with me for a while that I really appreciated everything it was doing and what it was going for and, you know, where it led the, you know, the trilogy. But they didn't realize just how mad people would get until they tried to overcorrect. And then it's like, oh, now everybody hates it. Not just people, just loud.
So it's funny because I had to watch it twice. And I saw it twice because I saw it like opening night with my wife. And then I went back with my kids. And it took like a second viewing where I was like, yeah, this is really good. Because the first time I saw it, I was like, I'm not sure, you know, what I think of this film. So I kind of can see that. So it, I don't know. I hate the idea of a movie studio reacting to a portion of the fans and bending to the will of those fans. Cause obviously, before The Last Jedi was released, like it would, like critics thought it was the greatest thing ever. And I agree. And Disney was so thrilled with it that they like, even before it came out, they're like, hey, Rian Johnson, how would you like to do your own trilogy? Which I think is still a plan. But then like the fans saw it and you had all these fans who just had decided what needed to happen in that movie and it didn't. And I hate those. Anyway, Return of the Jedi is what we're going to talk about. And Return of the Jedi is the third film in this trilogy. And I'm just going to frame it this way. The story of the original trilogy is the redemption of Anakin Skywalker or Darth Vader. And that's the whole point of the trilogy. So in this film, we got two stories going on. We have, we open with, doggone it. We open with a rescue crew that goes to Tatooine, and they've got to get Han Solo back because, you know, in Empire Strikes Back, he was frozen in carbonite and sent back to Jabba the Hutt. Well, about a half an hour later, they've rescued him, And they're off on
the most boring half hour of the original trilogy.
And they're off on the real adventure of this movie. And the movie has two plots. One is that you have a rebel group that has plans to the new Death Star that's in the middle of its construction, and they can destroy it, but they have to take down the shield, and the shield is being generated from the moon of Endor. So you have a rebel group that goes to Endor to knock out the shield, and you have the fleet that's going to show up in time to attack the Death Star when the shield goes down. And then the other plot is you have Luke, who is on Endor and realizes that Darth Vader is there. He's returned to see Yoda one more time. Yoda's about to die, and Yoda reveals that, yes, he confirms, yes, Darth Vader is Luke's father. And then the last thing he says before he dies is there's another Skywalker. We learn that that other Skywalker is Leia, because Luke talks to Obi-Wan, right? And kind of, it's, you know, when Obi-Wan says, well, from a certain point of view, what I told you is true, I feel like that's the biggest cop-out answer from Obi-Wan's, like, remember that crazy lie I told you about your father? Well, it's sort of true. But I also wonder, like, Yoda disappeared, he's now Force Ghost, why couldn't he immediately conference with Luke? Is there, like, a waiting period? There must be some sort of waiting period.
That's a good point. Yeah, I guess they. Do they have to go through ghost training?
They probably have to go through ghost training. Like, so yeah. I'm assuming then that that you have Qui-Gon Jinn is training Yoda for a couple years on how to be a Force ghost, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, it didn't take Anakin very long. It took Anakin only like a day.
By the way, for all the crazy fan service they did in The Rise of Skywalker, I think there was a missed opportunity to not bring back Anakin's ghost. I think that could have been A-okay. But anyway, back to this. The rebels end up on Endor, and they think they've got the shield situation all taken care of. But the Emperor knew they were coming. It's a trap. And so they're unable to take down the shield. The fleet shows up at the Death Star, which is fully operational. The shields aren't down. It's a trap. And Luke is with his father, Darth Vader, who takes him to the Emperor. And so you have the Ewoks on Endor, which are just like, they're midget Chewbaccas, right? They're midget Wookiees. And they help the rebels defeat the Imperial forces on the moon, so they do take out the shield eventually. In the meantime, while that is happening, Luke is fighting Darth Vader in the throne room in front of the Emperor. And it kind of goes back and forth where Luke is just fighting with himself. Do I fight my father or do I not? And I think the big turning point for Luke is when Darth Vader realizes that he has a sister, and he says, if you won't turn, maybe she will. And Luke goes crazy, almost kills Darth Vader, cuts off his hand, because Star Wars movies are all about symmetry. Then you have the Emperor, who comes down, and he's really, really happy because he's about to get rid of his old, beat-up, used apprentice who's no good anymore. By the way, I think I read that Darth Vader's only like 45 years old in this movie. He's not that old, right?
Wow. I'm almost Darth Vader's age.
I know, right? So, but the Emperor is like, he's hitting 90. He's close to 90 in this film. So the Emperor comes down, he's like, he's stoked because he's got a new apprentice. Luke is going to kill Darth Vader and take his place. And Luke throws away his lightsaber and says, no way, I'm not going to kill my father. You failed, I'm a Jedi. And then the Emperor says...
Did that ever, like, bother you, like, as a kid? Like, did he really expect Luke in that moment to be like, oh yeah, I kind of like killing, okay boss?
Well, Anakin turned so fast, right, in Revenge of the Sith.
I wouldn't say that, because it was like we saw the Emperor plotting for three movies to get it.
That's true. It was a slow burn
in a sort of blackmail at the end.
Yeah, that's true. So I don't know what the Emperor thought, right? I mean, but I guess he just thought that Luke had given in to his hatred, and the time was there. And then Luke said, nope, I won't do it. And the Emperor said, hey, Obi-Wan and your father forgot to tell you about this thing called Force Lightning. It sucks. Here it comes, right? So you have about 20 solid minutes of the Emperor Force Lightning Luke, and there's this weird moment that always bothers me every time I see it, when Luke's writhing on the ground, and it's like he puts his hand to his mouth, like he's adjusting his mouth guard or something. I don't know. Do you guys see that? Like, his hand just covers his mouth for a second, and maybe he's embarrassed because drool's coming out. I don't know. But I notice it every time.
I did notice the lightning in his teeth.
Yeah, lightning teeth, yeah. Right? And so Darth Vader is watching his son being killed by the Emperor, and Darth Vader, who's been kind of struggling, having this internal struggle the whole time. If you take Luke's word for it, Darth Vader has an internal struggle going on, right? And there's a moment well before this, before Darth Vader takes Luke to the Emperor, where Darth Vader says, "Obi-Wan once thought as you did, it's too late for me." So you know that there's some remorse in there. There's some wish to undo everything he's done. But anyway, he stands up and he kills the Emperor. And since we had to watch the special edition, we get to hear James Earl Jones go, "No, no." I think maybe the first no is okay, and the second one is just too much. I guess I can understand it. Maybe it's a little weird to have complete silence when he throws the Emperor into the power generator and kills him.
It was never weird.
I do like the lightning kind of strikes Darth Vader's suit, and you can see his skeleton within the suit for a brief moment.
So what was it about? Is Darth Vader's suit like metal or something, and so it amplified the electricity? Is that why he died?
So I the impression I've always gotten from this film, and you guys can correct me if you think I'm wrong, is that he had like bound himself to the Emperor to the point where he can't live without him. I don't think it was succumbing to his injuries, although he was pretty injured.
That makes sense, because that was just another thing that J.K. Rowling stole from Star Wars in the the binding of. What was it? Wasn't that like in the first book, that guy with the turban was bound to Voldemort, kind of?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So then what's the weirdest part is Darth Vader turns around, and you've never seen him from behind up until this moment, and there's this weird creature grafted onto the back. Anyway, I'm just kidding. But
nice.
But but Darth Vader, he collapses. Luke drags him out. He wants to save him because the Death Star, by the way, is imminently about to blow up. Because the rebels on Endor did their job. And
wouldn't it be great if the Death Star blew up because the Emperor fell into the middle of the Death Star where that big thing is they were trying to blow up, and you still like...
So
he exploded into it with his lightning.
I always thought it would be cool if Lando Calrissian, when he goes to shoot that power thing, you see like the Emperor's body falling through the air into that shot, right? But
Emperor lands on the impales himself on the, like, the satellite dish.
Sure. Yeah. So anyway, Luke is he's getting to a shuttle, and Darth Vader says, "Hey, I'm dying. It's too late, but I just want to look at you with my eyes," which means I don't know if we know what it looks like from Darth Vader's point of view through his suit, but
I guess
it's not real.
Predator vision.
Yeah. So we see. So being a Dark Lord of the Sith really ages you, because 45-year-old Darth Vader looks like he's about 100. Doesn't look great, but he's really pale. Super
bad image.
Yeah.
He's our grandfather at 45.
Yeah. So
you see old pictures of your grand. Oh, how old were you there? Like 60? No, I was 37.
Yeah, but so there's this great moment though where he's able to see his son with his real eyes, and then there's just kind of a smile, right? And then they part, and I won't get into more detail here because we will later. But Luke manages to escape before the place blows up. They all reconvene on Endor. There's a party. If you watch the special edition, there's parties in other places you don't care about, like Naboo. And they on Coruscant, they topple the statue of the Emperor, which it had to have hit someone, right? It reminded me of that moment from Robot Jocks when the robot fell on the stands. But
I have a hard time believing the people on Coruscant were aching to get rid of the Empire, because I feel like they were all benefiting from the Empire.
It seems like Coruscant was a pretty corrupt place, right? Like, that's where all the corrupty people live. So I don't know. But anyway, we come back to Endor. Luke does the Jedi. Did he know that that's how Jedi are supposed to be honored with a funeral pyre. Anyway,
that was the first thing Yoda trained him on.
It's like, by the way, if you ever have to do ceremonial rites, this is how it's done. So my summary's going way too long. He does that for Darth Vader. He looks off into the distance and he sees the Force ghosts of Obi-Wan, Yoda, and Anakin. And unfortunately, it's Hayden Christensen. I've got nothing against him. He's a good guy, but I just prefer the other actor that they had in the original theatrical cut.
Sebastian Shaw, I believe. I watched like a real good human being.
I'm really proud of you. Well, I had no means to watch the theatrical cut. Anyway, this is probably my second favorite Star Wars film. I really like it a lot. So that's the sum up, and now we can talk about whatever you guys want to.
After Rogue One? After
yeah.
Empire.
So it'd be after Empire. Rogue One is probably my number three. Isn't that weird? I think I like Rogue One more than I like The Last Jedi. Also, I don't understand because Disney bought Fox, and so Disney has... They own the rights to the theatrical cuts, right?
I don't know if they do. Maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe George Lucas had something. He's like, okay, you have rights to my stuff from now on or something like that. That's
interesting to think about. Because I know he's always messing with all the cuts.
Yeah.
Like who shot first and all that.
Oh my gosh. Maybe
Disney just doesn't want to do it.
Just figure it out and stick with it.
Yeah, I don't. It just seems like they could re-release the theatrical cuts and make some money because Disney cares about money, right? Why not just make a little extra money, right? But I would love to have the theatrical cuts back. And so all those digital editions, especially watching Return of the Jedi, because I think half of this film is simply digital editions on Tatooine, right? There's got to be like at least a half an hour of additional digital editions on Tatooine, which you don't need. Like, the Rancor is not digital, and the Rancor looks great. And I think we've talked about this before, and, like, the guys in the rubber costumes, obviously they don't look photorealistic, but they look like you could touch them. They look like they exist in the same room as the actors, right?
And for 83, it's better to look that way than being almost like CGI Yoda.
Yeah, yeah. And so, that was a great thing about the sequelogy, I guess, was that they brought back Puppet Yoda, right?
See, did you make up that word sequelogy?
I just did. I'm very proud.
That works really well for 7, 8, 9. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. So this movie's great because this movie is the movie where Luke has an opportunity to make all the wrong choices his father made, and you see it with the dark clothing. You see it with he actually force chokes the Gamorrean guards, right?
Yeah.
Which seems like a bit much.
He's dressed as the Dread Pirate Robert. So you know he's up to no good, but you know he's also, you know, after true love of his father, though. He doesn't really have any romance.
Yeah.
Okay.
We got to talk about twins, because that's what this category is about, right?
What do you want to talk about, twins?
I'll
mention this really quick. The whole idea, remember way back when we were kids, we knew there was going to be a prequel trilogy, and we also knew there was going to be a sequelogy. But then George Lucas changed his mind and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
But the original plan, I don't know if you read this, is that Leia was not his twin. Leia was his friend in the rebellion. She was Princess Leia. That was it. They kissed. There was potential for romance. She was not related to Luke. The original plan was the other Skywalker was Luke's twin sister named Twilla or something, some weird Jedi Star Wars name. But she was across the galaxy. And the episode 7, 8, and 9, it would have been Luke traversing the galaxy kind of in an Odyssey-type way, trying to find his sister. And so it's like the first set was the father, the second set was the son, and then the third set was going to be the sister. And so, can you imagine how different that would be? I kind of like that idea. I kind of like the idea of the next set of movies was going to be, you know, this long, like, journey, almost like, I feel like it would have been a little bit more like, you know, the Odyssey or like the Voyage of the Argo kind of thing. But I don't know. Did you guys read anything about that?
I hadn't heard that myself. I like you. I mean, I knew when the original trilogy came out, like George Lucas said, I've written an enormous backstory before I even started to film these three films, right? So we, like you said, we knew that there was a prequel trilogy, but I'd never heard, I did know that Darth being Luke's father was, no one knew that until the Empire Strikes Back, like, came out, except for, like, George and Luke, right? Or George and Mark Hamill. But I'd never heard that about, Leia not being his sister.
Yeah, true story. Cool. Yeah, so does she work as his sister? I mean, it's almost like, if George, I don't know, maybe it's a better idea, because maybe the whole bringing another character into the Star Wars universe is a little bit convoluted and unnecessary.
Yeah.
It is just a little bit like symmetrical, and it makes sense, like, especially if Leia is going to be hooking up with Han Solo anyway. We may as well just kind of make them related so that they're all like, so that the three of them are like a family kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I guess it works. It's convenient is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I almost felt like too, in like A New Hope, when the recording says it's from Leia, I can't remember what the recording says, but it's like, we need your help. We need your help. Right? Am I remembering this correctly?
Yeah, her plea to Obi-Wan.
Yeah. She's pleading to Obi-Wan, and I almost feel like Luke wants to go on that journey because he has an attraction to the girl.
He says she's beautiful, he right?
She's beautiful.
She's beautiful.
Okay, then, yeah. Okay. And I've only seen that movie once, so... Yeah, he has an attraction to her, and so that's just weird to add that in if you know that that is ultimately going to be his sister.
Yeah.
I think the twin thing was the last... It was like the last plot point George Lucas decided on with the original trilogy, and he decided on it probably, possibly, after they changed the name of the movie from Revenge of the Jedi to Return of the Jedi. I think it was very late in the game.
Hmm. So there's a couple of things I want to ask you guys about. So the first is, like, they fly that shuttle to Endor, right? And it's not a very big shuttle, but I swear, like, 100 people come out of that shuttle. Like his strike squad, right?
Just a couple carnies coming out of a clown car.
Yeah.
So it's like the carnies, because the carnies in the French movie, like every time they started dancing, suddenly 20 backup dancers were on scene, and so maybe that's how that works.
I think they like had them stacked up like in carbonite, like in the back of the shuttle.
But also, so I can't think of anything more dangerous in the Star Wars universe than flying a speeder bike in the Endor forest. It seems like chances of survival are real low.
How they're just whipping, like, and they're not. There's not a whole lot of ducking and dodging. It's a lot of just. There's that sequence where they're looking right at each other and staying straight for about 10, 15 seconds. There's no way you're not clipping a tree.
They're just going forward really fast, just hoping not to hit a tree. Well, I sure hope there's not a tree in front of me.
So I'll just say, like, I don't know if you guys have ever played Star Wars Battlefront, but we have it, and I've played the speeder bikes on Endor, and I survive about 10% of the time. So,
wow.
Yeah. And there's that moment where Luke turns sideways because, like, there's a narrow point, but, like, turning sideways makes his profile larger, doesn't it? So, anyway.
I know. I always think that. I'm like, oh, so you wrecked your speeder and you knocked your head off just now. I have to get into why I hate and love this movie. I hate it so much, and I love it so much. But let me get into the hate first of all. I think it's so annoying to me. This annoys me more than anything else because I think it's really, really obvious. And George Lucas says as much on the DVD commentary. He pretty much remade the first movie. He remade Star Wars, but he just, like, he had the beginning with Tatooine, where they have an adventure in Tatooine, and then they have a Death Star battle. And it's always bothered me that the Empire is just like, oh, we'll just build another one. And then he's just like, oh, we'll just go into the Death Star and blow it up again. And he said on the DVD commentaries, like, yeah, when I made the original Star Wars movie, I originally wanted to have a battle on the surface of the planet, and I wanted to have a lightsaber battle, and I wanted to have a space battle at the same time, but just it wasn't in the cards, you know. We just didn't have the budget, we couldn't do it. But I made the movie, and now it's done, and, you know, and then 3 years later, I have a chance to have all those things, so I wrote those into the movie. And so it just really bothers me that he pretty much remade this, the first movie that he already made. He was already in that mindset. Yeah. I'm just going to redo the stuff.
So if I understand it correctly, like if he knew he was going to make all three films, like if he knew he'd have the money and the ability to make all three films, then like the destruction of the Death Star wouldn't have happened in the first film. That was supposed to be a third film thing. But he thought, well, if I only get to do one movie, here we go.
Right. Maybe. Probably. I didn't read that specifically, but that's probably the case. I still don't believe him when he says, you know, I think he had, like, all this mythological stuff planned out, but I don't think he had, like, six movies or three movies or nine movies planned out when he made the first movie. I think he thought he was going to just make one movie, just because you only make one movie. I mean, that's like, what else was he going to think? The original movie, it was called Star Wars. It was not called Episode 4. I always have to talk about this. The Episode 4, it was added to, like, videocassette stuff later.
I feel like he may have had, like, an outline of characters and possibly, like, backstory. But you can't tell me he had a full-on, like, six movies or nine movies all laid out. Because if he did have nine movies laid out, wouldn't he have just given those to Disney as well and said, hey, here's kind of the track I was going under?
So,
like, can we follow this?
My understanding is when he sold Lucasfilm to Disney, is he said, Okay, go ahead and do three more movies. By the way, here's what he kind of gave them his idea. Like, this is where I would go, right? And I'm pretty sure Disney said, no, thank you.
I think they Roddenberried him. You know, like when Gene Roddenberry was losing control of Star Trek, he's like, yeah, no, I want to make the movie where the Enterprise goes back and stops the Kennedy assassination. Roddenberry was obsessed with stopping the Kennedy assassination. And
isn't everyone?
They put him in the ground. They put Roddenberry in the ground. He died trying to stop the Kennedy assassination. And everyone's like, I'm sure glad we didn't have to do the Star Trek where they stopped the Kennedy assassination. that's totally what Disney did. They're just kind of like, well, this is cute, but here's $4 billion. We're paying you $4 billion so we don't have to do your dumb ideas anymore. I think that's kind of the attitude.
Well, and possibly, you know, he made movie 5, and then he needed to introduce Luke's sister, and bringing on another character just didn't work. So maybe he just made Leia his twin sister that way?
Yeah, that's kind of what I think. It's such a big thing, though. It's such a big thing. I mean, by doing that, it solves a lot of problems, but I think it eliminates, like, an entire storyline which may have been garbage. Could have very easily been garbage.
And if they'd introduce a new character in the third film, it's like bringing Poochie into your cartoon, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think if George Lucas, if I were George Lucas and I had this idea, I think they would leave it with, there is another Skywalker, and that's the only thing that they would reveal in this movie. And then 10 years later, when they get around to the second set of trilogies, the 7, 8, and 9, that's when we learn what that line meant after the whole Anakin prequel trilogy. That's kind of what I would do, but, well, there's no way to know. I would love to get George Lucas on this podcast. I don't know if he's doing anything right now, but I would love to interview him with all these questions because I'm curious. There's so many things he's done that I've loved and so many things he's done that I've hated, but
well,
you have my respect. Yeah.
Well, and completing like just this science fiction epic, you know, like a science fiction, like fantasy epic, in like the entire galaxy, as big as everything is, and all these characters and all these plot points, it would be so hard to keep that in line. It's almost like, not to bring this up in this podcast, but it's almost like Game of Thrones, where like the story got so vast, like trying to reel it in is so difficult. And it's almost like the same thing here. I mean, the story is just so vast that trying to reel it in sometimes is very difficult.
Yeah.
That's interesting. It's like George Lucas is a pioneer in this world. And I think George R. R. Martin, like, there comes a point when you create a world where, yeah, it no one man can control the world anymore. I think that's why George R. R. Martin won't ever finish Game of Thrones, because he's like, it's like Atlas, he can't support it anymore. He's like, I've lost control.
Yeah. So I will say, like, the Star Wars is at its best though when it's intimate, right? When it focuses on like a core group. And that's again why I think like introducing a new character in this movie would have been weird, because we followed this core group of like six or seven characters for three films. And that's the magic of Star Wars, is how invested we are in just this small number of characters that we care about.
Right. Well, the events of Empire Strikes, I think we talked about this when we talked about Empire Strikes Back on this podcast. Like, the events of Empire Strikes Back, besides the Hoth battle, it would not have made the history books. It was about just a tiny group of people trying to survive in this universe and who care about each other. And that's what Empire Strikes Back is about.
Yeah, they don't even really accomplish anything of any note in that film.
No, yeah. Okay, well, let me talk. Okay, we have to talk about how boring the first half hour of Return of the Jedi is. It's the most boring half hour of any Star Wars movie. And but also, what's the deal with Luke's plan? Like, Luke's master plan to save Han Solo. Okay, so here's the situation. Han Solo is captured by Jabba the Hutt. Luke's plan is to allow Jabba the Hutt to capture R2-D2 and C-3PO. And then he sends in Chewbacca, already captured. And then he sends in and then Princess Leia gets captured. And then he's like, okay, I'm going to get captured. And then he just, like, Sir Lancelot's everybody after that.
Are we talking Richard Gere's Sir Lancelot from First Knight, or?
We're definitely talking John Cleese's Sir Lancelot from Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Okay. He kills like 200 people. Yeah. So it's funny. So I always think that when Luke is on the barge about to be executed and he gets his lightsaber and he starts swinging it wildly, that like how on earth did Han Solo and Chewbacca not get their heads cut off?
Like, Han Solo almost got Darth Mauled.
Yeah.
Like, he was the person they were supposed to rescue. Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of think of the rescue plan as like a plans A, B, and C. And I think that maybe there was a hope that Leia would have simply succeeded. And then when Leia doesn't succeed, then Luke is plan C. I have no idea what the point is of setting it up with
how would they convince Chewbacca to get captured again? Like, he put up a fuss in the first movie when Luke wanted to put, like, and it was Luke's plan again.
Yeah, I know.
Remember, Luke is like, yeah, we're going to put these binders on you, and Chewbacca freaks out. And then, like, in this movie, he's like, okay, Chewbacca, hear me out. You're going to get captured again.
That, you know, that happens in all three films. Chewbacca has to wear binders, right? So I also it bothers me that Luke, when he shows up, doesn't just have his lightsaber with him. Like, he again, like, you're right, he must think that I'm going to get captured, so I'm just going to stow my lightsaber. But it seems like his lightsaber would have come in real handy in his first appearance.
Right. And I mean, it was kind of funny. And Luke's, another part of Luke's plan is he walks into, okay, by this time, everyone's captured except for him because of his master plan. Everyone's captured. He's like, okay, so now my plan is to walk into Jabba's palace and then steal a gun from somebody and then gun Jabba the Hutt down. And that does not work. And he gets captured in the process.
Oh, man.
And then is forced to walk off the plank into the Sarlacc pit, and he does some Olympic maneuver on that plank.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then jumps onto the side of the barge and shimmies up the so I don't know. I think Luke's ultimate plan was he still got the hots for Leia. He knows if she gets captured, then he's going to get to see Metal Bikini Leia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the only, honestly, that's the only explanation.
By the way,
let's get Leia into the bikini.
The bikini drove him mad.
Oh boy.
I think it drove 85% of Star Wars fans mad.
Yeah. So if it that's didn't, a, pulse.
It's a weird thing with Lucas, right? Like, because he did the same thing in the prequel movies where he's like, why can't I think of the name of the actress who played Padme?
Yeah,
Natalie Portman.
He's like, hey, Natalie Portman, I've got a few outfits. You're going to love them, right? Like, she wears some crazy outfits in that second film. Like, there's like the, and it's weird because, like, her intent is supposed to be, distancing herself from Anakin, but she keeps wearing like the dominatrix dresses. So I don't know. George Lucas is kind of a little weird.
If you're to believe some of the trivia that it says in IMDb, part of it was Carrie Fisher's idea because she was so annoyed for going through two movies where she's like kind of playing a soldier. You know, she's like, you can't even tell I'm a woman in these outfits. And so he's like, all right, well, here's something that's going to be on our minds for 30 years. And yeah. Okay, well, let me ask this really quick. One thing I don't understand is Obi-Wan Kenobi and Yoda. Luke is like, oh, well, I think my father's good. And they're like, no, you must face him again. Why were they like, no, you have to fight Darth Vader again? And they kind of imply, you have to kill Darth Vader.
Yeah. So here's this is my take on it, and it's important. Right. It's okay. Because Luke... Because Luke had a special... Because he is his father's son. And so Luke can feel what Yoda and Obi-Wan can't. Yoda and Obi-Wan know, like, intellectually that Darth Vader has to be defeated, and they believe that it's too late for him to come back. But
that's
Luke
my question, though.
Is more
sensitive.
Why
does sensitive? Darth Vader have to be defeated?
I just think that they think it's too late, and if Luke tries to waste his time turning him back to the light side, that Luke's simply going to get turned to the dark side himself. And so it's easier just to defeat Darth Vader and be done with it, right? But I think Luke has the ability to sense that there's still a chance, and it's not just wishful dreaming by a son who probably never finds out that his father murdered about 30 7-year-old children. Uh-huh.
Where the faith comes from, not knowing that.
I wish they hadn't included that in Revenge of the Sith, because like the whole idea is that Darth Vader's supposed to be redeemable. But I just don't know how you come back from killing a bunch of kids. So,
well, they were a bunch of bratty kids.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, no, they're not good. Okay, but that leads me to, it's like, you know how much I hate the beginning of Return of the Jedi? I'm like, I kind of hate Return of the Jedi. I kind of hate what Return of the Jedi represents because it's so similar to the first movie. But I think, you know, when I show Return of the Jedi for the first time to people and they're like, oh, I don't know what the fuss is all about. The fuss is, and it goes back to what you said about the intimacy of it. This is an entire galaxy, and out of the entire galaxy, a father's son is the only one in the whole galaxy who has faith in him to do the right thing. And that's enough for him to do the right thing. And there's this weird thing. It's a weird power over me as someone who – does not have a father or never knew my father, and I don't have a son, but there's something I really relate to with the whole father and son coming together and, hey, son, I'm glad you had faith in me, and, you know, before he dies. There is something really magical about that, and that's kind of why I love this movie, even though I hate so many other things about this movie.
Yeah, it's the ultimate like payoff and reward, and I don't want to frame it that way, but like we talk about how this movie's best when it's intimate, but like you said, this is a movie about a father and a son, and like the whole idea behind you can always change is just such a powerful idea, right? That you can always come back from where you're at, and that sometimes you just need someone who really believes in you. And so I don't know. I love this movie. I think, by the way, the whole lightsaber battle in the throne room is really well done. But anyway.
Yep. Second best lightsaber battle of the original trilogy. So it's up there.
Okay. I've got a real quick question about the lightsaber battles.
Okay.
So what are your thoughts on the lightsaber battles in the first six movies compared to them in, say, episodes 7 and 8, where there's no jumping around, doing any backflips?
Okay, so I'm not...
Whirling it around like you are... whirling some nunchucks.
So it's possible you're referencing the Attack of the Clones where Yoda like goes turns into a spinning ball of lightsaber, right? So
yeah,
I don't know how I feel about that. I liked the idea of showing Yoda being able to show that like he is an accomplished Jedi, right, and he can actually use a lightsaber, and maybe it just would have looked ridiculous for them to be standing toe to toe and Yoda's only a foot tall with his lightsaber. I don't know. It does kind of look ridiculous. I will say I love the lightsaber battle from The Phantom Menace with Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan and Darth Maul. I thought that was a great one. I'm disappointed in the lightsaber battle at the end of The Last Jedi because I think it's just too short. So I'm only a little disappointed, but I gotta say that scene on, what's the name of that planet? That they end up on
the salt planet.
Salt planet, man, that the whole visual of the salt that when you brush it away, the planet's actually red. That's just so, that's gorgeous. It's beautiful.
I think it's crate.
Crate. You're right. It is crate.
Yep.
As far as lightsaber, I mean, I guess I could rank them all. I really like because the first one, back in 1977, it was just a couple guys swinging at each other. Nothing super fancy. There's like one spin in it. I feel like the second one, in Empire Strikes Back, was like, it was a little, it was almost like two knights going at it. There's like a lot of power in it, you know, a lot of two-handed sword action, you know, like some swift stuff. In Jedi, in this one, I felt like it was a little bit more fencing. And then in episode 1, it seemed like a little bit more martial arts sort of situation. In episode 2, it was just editing garbage. That sucked. in episode 3, it was a little bit better. And then in episode 7, I felt like it was kind of a little bit more like kind of samurai fighting. I kind of appreciate, like, I think there's like a weird, I wouldn't say progression, but there's an intriguing difference to them all. It's almost like each lightsaber battle is just a little bit of an homage to a type of fighting style in a completely different movie genre sort of thing.
Oh, I do love the lightsaber battle in episode 7, and I think the visuals play a big role in it for me, where they're in the forest and it's snowing, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that feels like a samurai showdown to me. That visual, it's beautiful. Anyway, all right. So we've spent some time on Return of the Jedi because it's a good movie. But there's another film we watched called Gone Girl about twincest.
yes. Okay. Roy, you can go ahead and talk about it.
It's all yours, John.
Oh, mine is... Oh, I'm... Okay, sorry. You just did Return of the Jedi. I have Twincest
Yeah, you Gone got Girl. Princess.
Okay, so in the movie Gone Girl, Ben Affleck, he wakes up, he finds his wife is gone. He's like, oh, that's weird. You know, he calls the cops, they start an investigation, and they're kind of like right from the beginning, like, ah, he did it, you know, because the husband always does it, right? And he's like, oh, no, I didn't do it. But then it gets worse and worse for him. Turns out he's having an affair. Turns out he's not that great a guy. Turns out he has a lot to gain. You know, she's like trust fund. She's rich. She's the one. Her parents don't like him. It's really, really bad news. Really bad news. They actually find her diary where she goes into great detail about some of the truths of when they were first together, when they got together, and, you know, that can be verified. But then she's like, by the end of the diary, she's like, I need a gun. I need a gun. This guy's going to kill me, you know. And then they find all the stuff that he bought with the credit card, you know, and it looks really bad. Looks really bad. Oh, and someone says, where's your pregnant wife? Did you kill your pregnant wife? And they check out the kitchen. Her blood is everywhere. So this doesn't look good. So anyway, you think the movie's going to end. Movie does not end. It
Jeff's
does
got
not
like an
end.
Hour and a half left.
Yeah. turns out, we cut to Amy. She's alive, and it's Rosamund Pike, the hot fencer from Die Another Day, as I got to know her. she is on the run. She framed her death. She's going to frame Ben Affleck. And she wrote that whole diary herself. She goes off, and it's all going to work, except a couple hillbillies take her money. And so then, in order to get back, she finds an old boyfriend. That's the one thing that's Amy's superpower, of course. She seduces men and then makes their lives miserable. But, you know, we can't excuse Ben Affleck. He's a bad guy. Also, Neil Patrick Harris is a bad guy. He's one of her old boyfriends. So she goes and meets up with Neil Patrick Harris, and he kind of takes her prisoner because he doesn't want to let her go because he's obsessed with her. And she's like, well, this kind of sucks, but, you know, fortunately, I have a plan. I plan for this kind of thing. She kind of she abuses herself. She frames him, and she murders Neil Patrick Harris in a very David Fincherian way, and it's gorgeous and beautiful, and the Trent Reznor Atticus Ross theme music is just blaring through that scene, and it's really gross and kind of hot and awesome. Anyway, Amy comes back, and Ben Affleck's like, what are you doing here? And she's like, well, no one's going to believe you, so we're together now, and we're going to raise this baby together. She's going to have a baby. That's how it ends. It's very weird. And it kind of is sort of like, hey, what do you reveal about yourself? What do you reveal to your community? And, you know, the person who – the right person in this world and the person who is innocent is the person who tells the best story. And that's what Gone Girl is about, and it's sick and twisted. How did you guys like it?
This movie was fascinating. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like when it first showed her, like with her checklist, I thought that maybe it wasn't real. For a little bit, like it was like Ben Affleck in his mind dreaming up another reason why he didn't kill his wife. But so obviously not the case, right? So I think in my notes I wrote at the very end that the ending was extremely unsatisfying. But I don't think the ending could have gone any other way.
Yeah,
because I think Ben Affleck probably deserved the arrangement they ended up with, right?
Yeah.
And like you said, that there's are there any good people in this movie? Maybe the FBI agent who looks like Hillary Swank from Logan Lucky.
yeah, she's pretty cool.
Maybe his sister Margot.
I couldn't find anything really wrong with Margot. She seemed like someone you don't want to get into a tussle with, but that's not like evil, you know.
Yeah.
No, I think. Oh, solid.
Very, very.
Sean hasn't spoken in a while. We can have Sean's thoughts, and then I will give you guys my thoughts. So,
absolutely.
Unless,
if
you guys have more to say, feel free.
Well, there's always more, but we definitely we haven't heard enough from you guys.
Yeah,
so
I
go
have
ahead.
More to say, but I'll say it later.
I mean, this movie, it completely blew my mind. I mean, and I've seen it probably a handful of times now, just in the rewatch, just because there's so many elements to it, and it's I mean it's a thriller. I mean, it's a thriller, and then it's also horrifying to think that, you know, for someone like me who's not married, you know, you think about what goes on out there in the world today, and of course this is an extreme take, but I mean you just don't know, you know, as the world gets further and further, you know, you just never know. And so you seeing this, I remember in the theater when it came out in 2014, I remember walking out of the theater saying, there's no way I'm ever getting married.
Yeah.
Just no, absolutely not. Like, that was the first thing I said. I said, no, never, you know, and then I've, you know, eased much on that stance. But I mean, every time I watch it, it's just horror. There's just some horrifying stuff in here that you just, in the mental game between people of just how, over time, it just erodes and people rub each other the wrong way. And what, I mean, just, I think you've got to do a little more vetting these days. you've got to vet and not wind up. But this movie, every time I've seen it, and when Tony picked it, I rewatched it again, and it blows my mind every time. And it is just, the ending is just a gut punch. Even when you know it's coming and you've seen it, like it every single time. And it's so, like you're saying, John, it's so Fincher with the, you know, he's got the way he films with that kind of like yellowish hue, like the, in his films. And it just gives you this uneasy feeling throughout the whole thing. And I really like this movie. It's surprisingly, for as diabolical as it is, it's really, the rewatchability of it is it really holds up. And so a big takeaway is just, you know, just vet your people. vet your significant others, please.
Speaking of rewatchability, this was the Ringer's rewatchables. It was one of the ones they talked about. It's kind of a good listen if anybody wants to listen to that.
Oh, it's that's a wonderful podcast. Anyway, so Fincher is probably my favorite director. Hmm. And aside from Zodiac, which I feel like is one of the most perfect movies ever made in Hollywood, and I don't think that any movie can be better than that. I feel like it's just perfect in every way. This is probably my favorite Fincher movie outside of Zodiac. And I just love just like the unsettling nature of this movie. From the very beginning, you get just a disheveled Ben Affleck. And then it just goes throughout his day. And then he comes home and his wife's missing, and you can see just he's lethargic about everything. He's kind of just like, oh, what's going on? And he doesn't really care about Amy anymore. So he's just kind of lethargic about it and doesn't really care. And then you see just the mess of everything that he has done to Amy. And Ben Affleck is a villain in this as well. Obviously, I don't think he deserved what Amy did to him. However, he's just as much of a villain as Amy is in this movie. And so I always kind of root for Ben Affleck in this movie. However, you can see that he is evil, and the last thing that gets said is, what will we do to each other? Like, what have we done to each other? It's so eerie, yet it's so well put together. I just love it.
Well, and credit to Ben Affleck, and I really thought about this when I watched it this last time, is like, what a good acting job he did in this film to play the character the way he did. Like, he just comes off as this such a smug, just, he's so unlikable in the beginning, which really helps the twist of the movie. But he's so he's so unlikable from the very beginning. Yeah, his lack of empathy, his just how he kind of half-asses life, and all those things. He's so unlikable, and truly, if Amy wasn't so diabolical, he would almost be irredeemable. But you do, at least for me, seeing it too, and it probably, as we talked about early, as you guys talked about, there's really no hero of this film, but you do kind of, at least for me, I do kind of side with Affleck and just like, yes, he was not a good husband. Yes, he's not. There's not really any likable qualities about him. But to get sent through the ringer like that and being ready to go to lethal injection, I mean, Fincher really, all of his movies are just a complete mind bender, and this one just.
Well, and you also have to think about Amy's backstory. So Amy grew up and she never, you know, she kind of struggled in school, yet her parents manufactured this childhood of hers and made it into, you know, like a child's story, and they made Amy perfect. Therefore, she gets like this sense of, oh, even if I'm not perfect, like my parents will almost make me perfect, or in this light, I can become perfect. So she's never really herself. She has to kind of morph and choose who she wants to fully show herself to, and she can't truly be herself because she wants to be something perfect for another person, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
just a high degree of narcissism from her.
So I wonder, can I ask, do you guys like Mindhunters?
The TV show or the movie?
On Netflix, the TV show that David Fincher did 2 seasons of.
Oh, yes, I love it.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good.
It's good. It's a hard watch, as all of these, like, as Fincher films tend to be. They're, I really like his films, but, like, when they touch on those subjects and you know, like with Mindhunter, I remember watching it, and it, as you continue to go through, and you're just wading through just human garbage after a while. Yeah. Oh man, like what am I doing with my life?
I will say, so like the actor they found to play Kemper in Mindhunter is just incredible. Like, that's the best casting I've seen on a TV show in forever. But so then let me. So you said you like Zodiac the best. So what's better, Zodiac or Paula Abdul's Straight Up?
That's a good video. Did you? Okay. Did you do? Do you have a list of all David Fincher's music videos?
I can find it real fast because yeah, like the first 15 years of his career.
I know he did Fields of Gold with Sting.
Good look. Yeah.
I mean, his credits are amazing.
So he had some favorites. He had Rick Springfield. Was his first music video was a Rick Springfield, and he did a bunch of Rick Springfield. I mean, if you look at his directorial credits, like two-thirds of it is music videos, right? Let's see. Eddie Money. There's an Eddie Money. There's Outfield, a couple of videos by the Outfield, the Motels. Madonna has one. A Lover Boy
Yourself
video.
That was a famous Madonna
Express
video.
Yourself, yeah. Foreigner.
Oh, he did Celebrate Youth. Okay, that was a great Springfield, Rick Springfield, because I remember that was the first time, that was like before like Schindler's List. In the Rick Springfield Celebrate Youth video, I remember this, it was in black and white, but just every once in a while there was just something in color. And so I remember that video really well, yeah.
So Jamie's Got a Gun, he did Vogue, he did the Vogue video for Madonna, and get this, he did The Cradle of Love by Billy Idol.
Oh, yeah, you can see that, right? That's a total David Fincher apartment.
Yeah. Want to know, do you guys already know what his first film was?
Yeah, because Alien 3. Just
Alien 3. Yeah. It was Alien 3, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, then he went right back to doing a whole bunch of music videos, and then his next movie was 7.
Well, because Alien 3 he directed, but it had so much studio, like studio was like stepping in saying, this isn't good, this isn't good. Yep. And so the movie that eventually got released was not the movie he directed. And he actually said that he was probably never going to direct a movie again until he was like 7. But he told the studio, I'm making my movie no matter what. Like, I will not get any pushback from you guys. And we get Fincher's 7.
So speaking of 7, there's that scene where Kevin Spacey shows up and he's covered in blood. That's exactly what I thought of when Amy comes home and she steps out of the car and she's just soaked in blood, right?
Yep.
It just felt just like that. So yeah, his second movie was 7. His third movie was The Game, which actually I love The Game. Number 4, Fight Club. And then Panic Room, which was okay. I saw it once. It was all right. Zodiac is a great film. I've never seen The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Of course, The Social Network. Then Gone Girl. Then he makes it to Gone Girl. Did he win Best Director for making? No, he didn't, because Best Director went to the lady who did Nomadland, right?
Yeah, that sounds
yes.
Right. That sounds right.
Chloe Zhao.
Yeah, he was nominated though for Best Director for Mank, right?
Yeah, I think he was also nominated for The Social Network as well.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, David Fincher, fascinating director, and so I wanted that. So something that I thought about with this film is you get the parts in the movie where Ben Affleck is playing himself and he's really unlikable. And he's like making all these excuses about why he doesn't like being at home and his marriage is awful. And it just sounds like, okay, you're having an affair. That's why you're saying these idiot things. But then when you learn that his wife's a psychopath, like, oh, maybe it really is miserable at home. So that was interesting. And then at the end, you have like this where it's leading up to where he's going to go on this interview and he's going to spill the beans, right? And then he doesn't. And I think it's perfect that he doesn't. I think that was the right way to end that. I think if it's him spilling the beans, I think that is the easy way out. This is the ending of this movie leaves you really unhappy.
That was my favorite. That's my favorite scene in the movie is when he's sitting there and Tyler Perry's throwing those gummy bears at him because he looks like a douchebag and is because he's just coming off and finally he finds it, and he's like in his what is it that his sister hands him? The watch that
yeah, he gets the watch and the tie. And
he's like, yeah, and she's like, you hate that watch. He's like, no, I love that watch, just like I love this tie, just like I love my wife. And it's just like and him being able to that when he's on TV and Desi's house, and she's watching that, and she's waiting for this enormous train wreck, and all of a sudden he becomes this semi-sympathetic figure because he admits all of his faults, and admits that he's been this just horrible husband and all these things, and then that little where he touches his chin at the end, that was if you can find a sliver of satisfaction in that movie, that's a satisfying moment where you're like, okay, of the sickest people in this film, there's no question that it's Amy, and Amy
and then she comes back and just says, the Nick that I saw on TV, that's the Nick that I want, that's the Nick that I married, yet that's not truly Nick.
Yeah.
And so she's got this perception, like this perfect perception of Nick, that who she thinks that he is, yet that's not truly him. He was playing a character in order to get her back, yet
he was playing a character.
That's not truly him. And she's not truly herself. She's trying to play up a perfect character so that Nick would like her. And then as soon as Nick started pulling away, she became her normal manipulative self, almost trying to pull what she did to Scoot McNairy.
Yeah. Oh. I love the sequence where she talks just briefly about, you know, being the cool girl. And, you know, how, like, these are the things she had to do. This is, like, you know, she had to drink crappy beer and, you know, eat pizza but remain a size 2. And, you know, like, I don't know. It was just like, fun stuff. Yeah, I can't remember what else she said. You know, I don't know if
watch
it was, like...
Sandler movies.
Yeah, watch Adam Sandler movies. And it's just, like, I mean, it's so weird. Okay, this is a movie about killers and manipulators and adulterers and everything, but there's something so weirdly universal about it, you know, in our troubled, horrifying 21st century lives, where so much of ourselves isn't ourselves, but just what we act out, because we're all acting out, because we all have our persona, you know, be it, like, you know, through social media, or just, you know, because we simply have so many more reasons, you know, when we go out and interact with each other, we do it in such a way where it's like, okay, I have to put on my work self, I have to put on my social self, I have to put on my lover self, and I don't know, I'm not sure 100 years ago we had all these different personas of ourselves that we juggled, but I, you know, even though these people are killing each other and they're having affairs with each other and they're just terrible people, I somehow felt like, okay, this is just us. This is just how we live. It's just a weird thing that we're always acting.
Yeah, and I feel like that's the endearing part of this movie for me, is that the you know, those psychological things, and we could dive in forever about the, you know, Eve Tony brought it up about how Amy, you know, her parents and the way that, you know, amazing Amy, and they wrote these stories of how they wished their daughter was, so she's got, you know, all these hang-ups, and and also, I mean, Nick uses the exact same move on his student that he used with Amy, so he's just, you know, like you were saying, like, we've all got these, you know, not in these extremes, but seeing how you act in certain situations and how you are, you know, how you are at home, how you are at work, exactly what you were just saying, John, and it's just that's the endearing part of this movie, and that's what really hits home is that we all in our own way have these different people that we feel we have to through insecurity, or for, like you were saying, to try to pick up women or to try to get a job or try to, you know, or just exist in society. And then when the doors, then what really goes on behind closed doors, nobody really knows. And so that's the endearing, you know, hauntingly horrifying part of this movie. So I really love this movie, the acting and all of it. I just, you know, it still scares me every time I see it, but that psychological side of it, I love that. And Fincher does a lot of that. So
when I first saw this in the theater, I left just with, like, the worst feeling in my stomach. Like, I was just like, ugh. And, like, I didn't even know if, like, I liked the movie. Then when I watched it again, I watched it after it got released. Then I was just enthralled with it. And I actually watched it on back-to-back days, and I've just been enthralled with it ever since. Like, it's just, and my favorite parts of the entire movie are just, like, the first 50 minutes of just the Ben Affleck experience, just from going to, just from everything Ben experiences, and just the storm that just starts brewing from his decisions, and he's seemingly has no way out, and then he has no idea if she's actually dead or alive. Then all of a sudden he realizes she's actually alive, and it's just up and down. And then you have Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor's music in the background, and just the tense nature. It's trippy, yet it's just so well done, in my opinion. And it's just a great watch for me. And I don't know what that says about me as a person, but...
Well, we know, if you don't.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think I'm good with Gone Girl. I have a lot of awards for it, as I have for all three movies. You guys ready?
Ready.
I do want to just say...
Okay.
I want to say two more things.
All right.
One, David Fincher is a total perfectionist.
Huh.
Like with all of his movies. And so there is a scene in that in Gone Girl when he's at the airport and he puts on a New York Mets hat.
You got to say it's from the book, because in the book that's what...
No, hold on. Hold on. Okay. And he puts on a New York Mets hat. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
So he puts on a New York Mets hat. However, in the book, it's a Yankees hat. And Fincher wanted it to be a Yankees hat because it felt more real. He felt like it felt more real to the character. However, Ben Affleck is from Boston and he hates the Yankees. Therefore, he refused to wear a Yankees hat. And Fincher makes a joke saying that they shut production down for 4 days trying to get Ben Affleck to wear this Yankees hat, and he never would. So they settled on the Mets hat.
That's pretty funny. I would say, I mean, as a baseball, as someone who doesn't love baseball and who perhaps actively despises baseball because it's dumb, I do think it's like, I do think that's kind of a funny story, and I'm kind of like, well, Ben Affleck, you know, grow up, just wear the hat. But he may have had a point, because everybody knows that Ben Affleck is from Boston. Like, that's the one thing that everybody knows, right? And he is, right? Because, you know, isn't that like Good Will Hunting stuff?
Yeah.
Yep.
And so I think it would have been actually extremely distracting in the movie, like, to have everybody talking about how Ben Affleck wore a Yankees hat in the movie. And so I think Ben Affleck, I think he made the right decision. I don't know if something this silly should have held things up for 4 days, but I'm glad they worked it out, I guess.
Yes. Okay, we can move on and we can go to categories.
So I have to, there's one thing that I forgot to mention that okay. that was important. Well, not important, but I thought interesting. All the way back to French musical. Did you know that that the casting was originally going to be Brigitte Bardot and what's her head?
Brigitte
and Audrey Hepburn were the original twins.
Oh, I think I did.
Oh, wow.
I think I did hear that.
Yep.
That's weird.
Didn't work out.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's fine.
Keep
it in France.
I also heard it took them 2 years because they had to wait for... Oh, what's the guy's
Gene
name
Kelly.
In that?
Gene Kelly.
Yeah. They had to wait for Gene Kelly. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Gene Kelly, I know he's a legend and everything, but creepy vibes, I think.
So
that young girl like, shouldn't have gone after him.
So in a similar movie, there is an Audrey Hepburn movie called Funny Face. And the mm-hmm. love interest in Funny Face, by the way, Audrey's like early 20s in Funny Face. The love interest is Fred Astaire, and he's got to be in his 60s. And he looks like he's in his 60s, and it's so awful. But anyway, I'm fine.
Gross. Okay, ready for awards?
Yeah.
All right, Roy, best title.
The best title is Gone Girl.
Oh, wow. You want Gone Girl. Okay.
I stuck to Return of the Jedi in the same vein of Batman Returns. Who doesn't love, you know, the Return of the Jedi? Bring it back. Just bring it back.
They should have called it Return of the Batman.
that should have been the name.
Yeah. All right, Tony, do you agree?
I went with Gone Girl as well. Just short and simple and, you know, it kind of leaves you like, oh, what's this going to be about in a way, you know?
And it's ambiguous. It makes sense when you think he killed his wife, but then like when when you learn what's really going on, it's like, oh, okay. So it, I, anyway.
Whenever yeah. I think yep. of Gone Girl, I think there's a, I think it was a an old In Living Color sketch called Go On Girl about a bunch of girl empowerment girls, and I think they got foiled by, you know, by stumbling over each other, like trying to find a man or something. I can't remember it very well, but I remember them saying Go On Girl. So, okay. I'm going to go. I agree. I think, I mean, not with Gone Girl. I agree with Return of the Jedi. Because I like the idea, because we all thought back at the time, we're all like, oh, here comes Luke. Luke is back. He's a Jedi now, and he's returning for this final movie. But no, it's about Anakin. And after like 20 years or whatever under the Darth Vader suit and a slave to the Sith, he is redeemed and he is returning. So.
That is the first time I've thought about that title that way.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's totally the title. Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's good. Okay. Tony, best poster.
I'm going to go with Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, it's good. It's got that blueness. Of course, there is a mistake on it because I think Luke's lightsaber is blue instead of green. But, you know, it's one of those old paintings with the darkness in the back and Darth Vader. I agree. I like Return of the Jedi. Tony?
However, Ben Affleck looks pretty good, though.
He does look good. Okay, no, Sean, sorry. What's your poster?
Yeah, I went Jedi also.
Okay, this is probably the winner overall. Roy?
The young girls from Rochefort.
Boo!
Oh,
it's we wild. Could have had a 4-for-4.
No. Sorry.
Okay.
No, that poster tells you everything you need to know about that musical. 60s French dancing and singing, so.
Well, then you may as well not see the movie.
That's why I didn't. Okay.
All right, Roy, as long as you're talking, best opening credits.
Okay. Well, it's not Return of the Jedi because there are none.
You
I'm going to go.
Count the crawl as the opening credits.
I don't. I don't. So I thought the opening credits to Gone Girl were pretty good, but I liked the young girls of Rochefort.
Yeah, with that bridge.
Oh yeah.
And the dancing.
And the dance.
And young George Chakiris.
How young is he? Okay. Anyway, we'll get to this.
We'll get to him later. I agree. I picked Young Girls of Rochefort. I'm like, holy cow! This is a movie. This is a Technicolor for my ears. Yeah. Sean, what do you have?
Yeah, I went Rochefort too, only because we can't technically count the crawl, so I went Rochefort.
Okay. Tony?
Okay, if we're not counting the Star Wars scroll, then I'm going to go with Gone Girl just based on the music from Ross and Reznor just sets the tone of the eerie mood for the entire movie. So
it's a strong opening credits. I really like it.
You know, we can count the crawl if you want. If we counted the crawl, would you do Star Wars?
I would.
All right. We'll make
you almost have to because it's just iconic.
It's great iconic. Yeah, great iconography. Okay, Tony, what about technology?
Well, I think you have to go with the lightsabers.
They're all right, Sean.
Yeah, I mean, how are you going to argue against the lightsaber? I also, what are the, we were just talking about it when they're racing through the forest with those,
the
on those
bikes?
Little, yeah, the speeder, give me the speeder bike, give
those,
me that all.
Those are sweet, yeah.
I would kill for one of those.
Okay, Roy.
So also from Return of the Jedi, there's a scene where you see a bunch of Ewoks ready for battle, and they've got, like, weapons, and one of them is holding, as a shield, a patch of tree bark. So I'm going with the tree bark.
Tree bark.
Oh.
Yeah.
Tree the bark. Okay. I guess I'm the only one who picked the technology from Rochefort, and that is the famous Rochefort transportation bridge.
One of only, like, 20 ever made, right?
Yeah, something like that. It's like a weird, it transports entire sections of road so people can dance while they're crossing the river outside of their cars.
Oh,
it's beautiful. Okay, we're on to best food. Did anybody pick Stormtroopers? Because the Ewoks definitely ate the Stormtroopers. Roy, what
do you
have?
I did not.
Okay, so from Gone Girl, he looks into the fridge for dinner and decides to just pull out a quart of ice cream.
Okay, there are actually a couple of sections of ice cream in Gone Girl. I'm going to get to one of those later. Okay, Tony, what do you have for food?
From Gone Girl, that cream dish Amy was eating during the special with Sharon Schreiber.
That was the ice cream I was thinking about. Right?
Well, so that cream dish, and then she starts eating Desi's.
Yes.
And yeah. Desi gives her some look like, oh, that's not going to work.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, because, like, she starts eating Desi's, which it was great, and then Desi, like, took it away later, because I think later he said, okay, I think we could get you into the gym tomorrow. Like, he was like...
So Desi wants her to remain a size 2 as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's totally what I thought. I thought I was awesome how she took his ice cream and then he took it back. And yeah. Okay, Sean, do you have food?
Yeah. So I was gonna go with Gone Girl as well. When she's in the car, like right as it opens up, and she says, "I never felt as good as I do now that I'm dead." And she takes a bite of that huge hamburger.
Oh.
Now there's just something about the fact when she said she had to remain a size 2, and the freedom of that, like every one of us has experienced. You know, you're not trying not to eat a burger. You're trying not to be fat, but at some point you just don't give a damn. And at that point, you just let it loose. And I would say that was second only to the spit-filled Mountain Dew.
Oh
yes.
That girl with the big loogie, and she takes that. Oh hell yeah! Just that quick, and you're just like, oh gosh,
that Mountain Dew pre-spit. I feel like that I have taken a drink of like my Mountain Dew and just said those same words, like, oh hell yeah, like after the sip, just.
I do love Mountain Dew. I was actually kind of thinking, I was thinking about bringing this up. Like, you know, sometimes we might want to do these categories like, you know, what food do you most want to eat? Like, if you could only eat the foods that we've hit, I would probably consider the Mountain Dew just because I rather enjoy Mountain Dew. And maybe if someone spit in it, it's still Mountain Dew. I think I could still do it. You know, that's fine. That was an awesome scene because Amy, like, totally got up from where she was sitting and ran over to her cup and spit in it and then ran back. Like, she could have blown everything right there, but she just had to spit in her drink, and I thought that was great. Okay, the food I actually picked, though, is the frites from the cafe. The Carney's Order frites, which were just French fries. And so, hey, when in France...
When you're going to eat carny food.
Yeah. Eat the carny food. Okay. Roy, what do you have for best name?
Okay, so from the Young Girls of Rochefort, I have Maxence.
Maxence, I thought about him. Yeah. Okay, Tony?
I had Salacious B. Crumb.
I thought about
Jabba's
Salacious
pet
Crumb.
Monkey.
Yeah. That was a famous one. Okay, Sean?
I went Darth Vader, only just for the iconography there.
Mm-hmm.
Good name. Okay, I went Gone Girl here. Rhonda Boney.
Yeah. Rhonda Boney.
Yes.
I love Rhonda Boney. She's such a great character. Kim Dickens does a great job.
Nice. Oh, that's who it is. She's good. Okay, Tony, while you're talking, what do you have for best outfit?
Oh, I'm glad I get to go first. I'm going to go the iconic metal brassiere that Carrie Fisher was wearing that George put her in.
All right, I put that down too. I have an honorable mention that I'll mention later, though.
Right. That's got to be the winner.
Yeah, it is. Sean, do you agree?
Yeah, I also went metal bikini. I'm just not, or I can't, yeah.
Okay, Roy?
Okay, so in The Young Girls of Rochefort, the first time we meet them, they're wearing those white dresses that have those slits that, like, with just the little bits of yellow or pink, depending upon whose dress you're looking at. And then when they move, they like flare out, and you can see the color. And that's my favorite, and I prefer the yellow one.
Nice. Okay, that's a good group. I picked the slave girl Leia bikini outfit, but my honorable mention is also in Young Girls of Rochefort, and that's when they do the fair, and they're in those red dresses with the massive slits.
The shimmy dresses.
Yeah.
And I was like looking so forward to the dresses, because 10 minutes earlier, like, Delphine brings the dress to Solange, and Solange says, "Won't we look like whores?" And she's like, "I didn't think about it." And I'm like, "Oh, I can't wait to see those dresses." And then they wore them, and it was great. Okay. Roy, best alien. Some picks
so,
this time.
Because this one is so on the nose, I'm going with Mon Calamari.
The Admiral Akbar people.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. That's, yeah, yep. Yeah, his whole race, they're named after seafood. So
seafood. Yeah, good for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, do you think that's why they're fighting the Empire? They were sick of being consumed, literally, in fancy Coruscant restaurants.
Mm.
Sean, do you have a best alien?
I did. I went Jabba the Hutt.
That's a good alien.
So slothful. Just a hideous... absolute sloth, and just I remember when we were young, we would go over to my grandma's house, and she my uncle was on his mission at the time, and so we got to raid his room, and that's where we'd watch Star Wars. And I remember not understanding Jabba the Hutt at all, but he just stuck with me, so we're gonna go Jabba.
It would have been interesting if they kept the original Jabba the Hutt. I don't know if any of you saw the original Jabba the Hutt scene in the original Star Wars movie that was cut out, but Jabba the Hutt was just a normal human guy, like when they originally filmed it, but then they cut that scene out, and so then they have the opportunity to make him a weird worm. So I guess it's kind of fortunate that they cut that out so they can have an iconic alien. Okay, wait, who hasn't said they're alien yet? Tony?
I have not.
Okay.
And keeping... on par with we're gonna do a mix of Fincher and Star Wars here. I obviously went with Jabba the Hutt as well. And now how I'm gonna bring Fincher into this is how many of the seven deadly sins do you think Jabba the Hutt makes up? I mean, he's gluttony. We got sloth. We got,
I don't know how lust works with Jabba unless his tongue is the sexual organ.
But, well, we definitely saw it, though, right?
Yes.
Well,
we got greed, wrath. I mean,
he's got at least five of the seven.
Yeah. Remember the first dancer girl? Like, who fell into the Rancor pit?
Yes.
She fell into the Rancor pit, I think, because Jabba the Hutt was, like, trying to, like, lust her somehow. Which I guess probably means just sticking her in his mouth, I guess. I don't know.
I assume that's how he does it, right?
Yeah.
I think he fills all seven. He does.
Yeah. No, that's pretty good. Okay. Okay, my alien... I'm going with Chewbacca.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's good. Okay. Sean, best special effects.
Oh, we've got it. It's got to be Jedi for me.
Well, which event in Jedi? Like.
Okay. So if we're looking, you know what was interesting to me is that I never knew. Is that when you see all the stormtroopers, when they all line up on the out on the port right there, or like outside, they're all lined up right there at the beginning, and you see that, then that's actually a painting.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Yes.
It's just so in, like, the background?
Yeah, so it's so when you see, like, the stormtroopers lined up at the beginning, it's just what it is it was actually a painting, but you can't tell that. And so I guess you could call that, it's not truly special effects, I guess, but if we're getting really technical, the effect of it just being a painting to look like there's, you know, hundreds of stormtroopers right there, and it's just a painting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Movie magic, you that counts.
You have to check that out and do some looks. So we'll, that's a deep dive, I would say. So let's go with that.
Okay, no, that's good. Okay, Tony.
I like that all of the aliens are in costumes or they are puppets for just like the realness of it. And, you know, there's nothing like speaking to, you know, something that's actually there rather than just like a man in a ghillie suit.
So it,
or Jean-Claude Van Damme in a fake Predator costume.
In a Q-Bert suit, yeah.
So isn't it weird to you that like these movies, like where they're so obviously not real, but we just accept it as real. We just buy it, right? Because like no one saw Yoda for the first time in The Empire Strikes Back and was like, that's a Muppet. This is stupid, right? You just buy it. It just works. So anyway. John, my favorite special effects because of the how cool it was to see it as a kid was got to be the Force Lightning.
Oh, okay, Force Lightning. I didn't think about that. I think I really like the speeder bike sequence. I think, you know, they did that really well because they filmed, I think, one frame per second just of walking through the forest to get those forests flying by, and then they just sped it up really fast, so it was at 24 frames. But also, I really like just the scope of the Death Star, that these model ships were flying inside this big other giant thing. Okay, Roy, best location.
Oh, it's not even close. I'm going to Rochefort in the 1960s,
yeah.
Assuming everyone is always dancing.
Yeah, I mean, how could you not? I don't know. You know, it's one of those things where I'm, like, pissed at the girls. Like, why do you want to go to Paris so much when Rochefort is this delightful? Like, what's wrong with you? Tony, what do you have?
I also picked Rochefort in the 60s. I have another one, since I'm sure everybody's going to pick that.
Okay.
Then I wouldn't mind visiting Sawyer Beach this time of year.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah. That's a good place to think. Think about your marriage. Yeah.
It's a good place to think about your marriage and be alone.
Okay, Sean, what do you have?
Yeah, it's Rochefort.
Nice. Oh, that's lovely. Did anybody look it up? Is it real?
Yes, it's real.
Okay.
And the bridge still functions.
Yeah, we got to... How many people do you think dance on that bridge? Like, come on, everybody, let's do the Rochefort dance.
I think only sailors are allowed to dance on it now.
Only sailors and carnies.
Nice. Yep. Oh, cool. Okay, Sean, do you have a best song?
I do, and this is obscure, but do you remember in the beginning when they go into Jabba's lair and all those aliens are playing like some form of music? It's some random... Whatever it is, I don't even know what to call it. It's just a futuristic jazz. I went with that.
I think it's called folk jizz, I think. like that's literally what it's called. It's called jizz something. Jizz harmony or something. Jizz is part of it.
I can get with it.
Tony, what do you have?
Some of the songs from Rochefort should be mentioned here. I don't know any by name. Mm-hmm. I didn't. So I'm going to go with an obscure one, obviously, as well, from Gone Girl, when Don't Fear the Reapers being played in Nick's car.
I wrote that down.
Which I think is just a sign of things to come. And it's just kind of, what are the chances that's what he's listening to at that time? And it's just kind of a nice... throw in.
Don't Fear the Reaper is a classic around these parts. Speaking of, Roy, did you pick Don't Fear the Reaper?
I didn't. I was tempted to pick Saved by Zero by The Fix.
I thought about Saved by Zero, yeah.
But I went with The Song of Summer Day from the Young Girls of Rochefort, and that's the song that they sing in the red dresses at the fair.
Oh, okay, that's the red dress. So you didn't pick the, we are two twins and we're Gemini and da-da-da.
I listened to it again. I like the Summer Day song better.
Okay, well, I'm surprised you didn't pick the song De Hambourg gar Rochefort, which was the middle song, which was, you know, the carnies and them, when the carnies convince the girls to do the fair, and they're in the, and then they all start playing all the instruments in the room, but oh, yeah, the song continues on, and it's like, Roy, in your comments, you said this is the one day more of this movie, because...
Oh yeah!
Every single character sings about what's going to happen to them tomorrow, and who they like, yeah, and you know what's going to happen next in the movie, and then Act Two starts. So that's a great one.
Very
it's
good.
Like 4 minutes long. Okay.
Was that your pick?
Oh yeah, that's my pick.
Okay.
Okay, Roy, best guest star.
It's got to be Gene Kelly.
Oh, of course it's Gene Kelly. I didn't think of that. I went elsewhere with this, and I'll explain myself in a minute. Tony, who did you pick for guest star?
So I struggled with this, and I actually saw Sean's list, and I agree with Sean's list, so I'm going to let him say it.
All right, go ahead, Sean.
All right, it's got to be Patrick Fugit from he's the assistant to the what's her name?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and of course, we all know him from Almost Famous.
Almost Famous, the Almost yes. Famous kid.
Yeah, yes. That's kid. When I saw that, I was just blown away. That was near and dear to my heart. Also, a fun fact about Patrick Fugit, born in Salt Lake City.
Oh wow.
Didn't know
so
that.
So I had to look up his name because I couldn't remember it, but yeah, born in Salt Lake.
Nice. Way to go, Fugues.
Fugue State.
Yeah.
Fugue State.
All right. My pick is Francois Dauliac, and that is Solange, tragically a guest star, because she was killed in an automobile accident like 3 months after this movie came out. Yep. And she was only 25, even though she looked 20 years older than Deneuve, which is weird, and also weird that they are literally sisters, even though I don't think they look similar at all. they didn't even have similar names, but rest in peace, Francois Dauliac.
Yeah, Deneuve is the one who changed her name. Their parents are the Dauliac. Is that how you say it?
Dauliac. I don't know. Roy, best external recurring character. Who did you enjoy from a previous Yours, Mine, and Theirs movie?
Well, playing a small but important part in White Christmas, we have George Chakiris.
That was mine. That's who I picked.
Yep.
George Chakiris. He wasn't a small part. He was like the good dancer in White Christmas. He was the only one who could keep up with not Rosemary Clooney, the other one.
I can't remember her name. It's like Ella something. I can't remember. I know who you're talking about.
George Chakiris, most famous, of course, for playing Bernardo in the original West Side Story.
Very good.
Yeah. Sean, do you have a best external recurring character?
I sure do. That would be one Billy Dee Williams.
Yeah.
From Batman. You know it's always going to tie back to one of those somehow.
And Nighthawks.
And Nighthawks. And Empire Strikes Back.
Yes.
Wow, lots of Billy Dee in this podcast. It's perfect. Okay, Tony, do you have an external recurring character?
Yeah, I tried for this, but I just settled on David Fincher. I know it's just director, but that's what I settled on.
Hey, but you got it... Okay.
Well,
okay.
You did get that right. What was the other Fincher movie we watched?
You guys did Fight Club.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. We did Fight Club. Okay. That leads us right into the internal recurring character. Roy, go ahead.
It's David Fincher.
David Fincher was in Return of the Jedi.
Yes, he was, as an assistant cameraman at ILM.
That's amazing.
No way.
Yep. So he, in between, like, he was... not yet ready to do music videos for Rick Springfield. That was another year away. He was cutting his teeth on ILM camera work.
Yep. So, he learned how to be a perfectionist from George Lucas, I guess. But I guess he learned better. okay, did you guys... Tony, did you have an internal recurring character? This one's trickier.
Yeah, so I went with a theme that was repeated between the three movies.
Twins?
I did go with twins. However, I do have a funny catchphrase that I think works.
Okay.
I hope you know before it's too late.
Really?
That's good.
Okay. Was that
a reference to Luke and Leia.
Okay, perfect. Alright, Sean, do you have an internal recurring?
I didn't fill this one out. Somehow I missed it. So let's stick with Fincher. I don't think that one can be topped anyway.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of the right answer. There's a place in IMDb where you can type in, like, who was in all three of these movies, and that's, like, the one that pops up, you know? So it's kind of the right answer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Best death. Now, before everybody says your death, remember, the Emperor does not count. Because he does not die, apparently.
Yes, he does.
As much as we hate to admit it, you can't pick the Emperor.
So he dies. So but he had cloned himself. Did you only see Rise of Skywalker once? It's a clone.
Wait, is that what he says in Rise of Skywalker?
Yeah, before he died, he had established a cloning, a set of clones for himself, like as a contingency plan.
Oh, I thought he only talked about cloning, like, Snoke and stuff.
No, I don't know about that, but he dies in this film. It's and it's definitely what you see in Rise of Skywalker. It's a clone. Yep.
Which just adds to the frustration.
That's annoying. That is annoying. Okay, Tony, what did you pick for best death?
Neil Patrick Harris getting sliced.
That's a big one. That's a big one. I remember the gasps in the theater. It was fun. Okay, Sean.
Yeah, I also went with Desi Collins getting hit with the box cutter right across the throat we know what he was about to do, and it didn't happen.
Okay, Roy.
Oh, I think I have to go with Anakin Skywalker.
That's good. Yeah, that has meaning. As did the Emperor at one point. Okay, I also went with I really like the Desi death, but I also want to point out the biker scout that Luke threw into a tree as they were going like 200 miles an hour, and he hits the giant tree. And then of course all the Bothans. That was a good death. So many Bothans died. So good riddance to Bothans. Okay. Roy, before next is best villain. First of all, I'm going to talk about. I just want to mention this is kind of funny. I remember back in 1983, my brother was reading like a Life magazine or People magazine or something, where everyone was trying to get info on this new movie, Return of the Jedi, or probably Revenge of the Jedi at the time. It's like, you know, what's going to happen? Who's it going to be? And in the article, they said, okay, we don't know exactly what's going to happen in this new Star Wars movie, but one thing we do know, Luke Skywalker is going to face an even more powerful villain than Darth Vader. His name? Bib Fortuna. which of course is Jabba the Hutt's just weird servant guy. Somebody at Lucasfilm told this magazine that Bib Fortuna was going to be the most evil villain in the movie. So anyway, honorable mention to Bib Fortuna for me. Really quick, all just as long as I'm talking, I'm just going to go with Amy. I think Amy is the best villain of this bunch. Tony, what do you say?
I said Amy as well. I mean, realistically speaking, she's just horrifying.
Yeah, yeah. She's freaky, she's calculating, and she's also right in a lot of ways. Sean, what do you have?
It's Amy. I'm still scared shitless.
Roy, you want to make this complete?
Sort of. So, you know, Bennifer kind of started the two celebrity couple names in one, so I'm going with Namie, Nick and Amy. They're both awful.
Namie. Okay, cool. And who's your hero?
I'm going to go with Anakin Skywalker, who finally brings balance back to the Force.
Good for Anakin Skywalker for coming back. I'm going to go with Luke Skywalker for bringing him back.
Very good.
Okay, Sean, what do you have?
It's Luke.
Nice. All right, Tony.
I went with Luke as well.
Way to go. Go Skywalkers. Good job, you guys. Okay, Tony, do you have a best goof?
Yes. And I would like John to confirm this. So the dancer that Jabba drops into the Rancor pit partially loses her top as she falls in, exposing her breast.
That's true.
This was she kept sure in the theatrical and special edition. Is this true?
Yeah, I actually also read that, but I think I did. I can kind of picture it in my head. I think I didn't internalize it, but I can kind of picture something happening with the top, yeah.
It's there. And so it's weird because George does all the tinkering, but he never thought, huh, for a kid's movie, maybe I should cover her boob back up. But it's like in Ghostbusters where there's that really brief moment where like the creature's hand pulls Sigourney Weaver's sweater down, but you don't notice it unless... I mean, I don't know. But anyway, yeah, it's there. It happens.
Yeah, okay. So we got some malfunctioning wardrobes happening in Jedi. That's fine. Okay, Sean, do you have anything?
Yeah, so on the part on the forest moon of Endor when Princess Leia first meets like the Ewok, she takes her helmet off and she's holding it in her hand. Yeah. And that like scares the Ewok, but then in the very next shot, she's removing it again to show him.
Oh.
So, come on, George. What are you
continuity.
Doing?
Mm. I thought you were going to say it's like, hey, this Ewok doesn't know what a hat is when the Ewok itself is wearing a hat. It's like, come on, you're wearing a hat.
that you could we just tack that right on.
Yeah. Okay, Roy, goof.
So, yeah, in Return of the Jedi, like, someone forgot to edit out all this crappy CGI. And they accidentally left it in the film. So that seems like a pretty big mistake.
That's a big mistake. That's good. Okay. Honorable mention in Return of the Jedi, and this has always bothered me, but it can be explained away, so it's not, like, officially my pick. But when Luke says to Leia, do you remember your mother? Your real mother? And Leia says, yeah, she was very beautiful, but sad. So anyway, but the person Leia's talking about is someone who died in childbirth giving birth to Leia. So there is no way Leia can remember that unless, I guess, if Leia has the Force, then she can Force project backward into the past and maybe have some idea of who her mother is. I guess if the Force can do that, maybe.
Maybe Jimmy Smits let her look at a picture of Natalie Portman occasionally when she was growing up. I don't know.
Right. But she still had to know her mom to be sad. I guess she... Yeah. Was it a picture of her just frowning? Just... she was frowning while doing something nice.
Did she have her feet in the sand?
Yes. No. Yes. What? I don't get it. What do you mean?
In episode 2, her and Anakin are talking about sand.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, her feet and were they in just sand. Have that... The sand made her sad. And she
sand
was like,
made her sad.
That could be it, yeah. Okay, no, my real answer is Amy's parents set up a tip line, and the number is 1-855-4-AMY-TIPS. So there's one extra number in the number, one extra digit. It should have just been 1-855-AMY-TIPS.
Those stupid idiots.
Yeah.
That's why they didn't get any good tips.
Yep.
That's for...
LOL, what do you have for laugh-out-loud moment?
Oh my gosh, okay. I actually laughed out loud at this. Okay. So, when we're first introduced to Gene Kelly...
Yeah.
And he gives his great dancing number... And at the end of the dancing number, he's tap dancing in front of all those kids right next to the car. And so he's finishing his tap dance. He smacks one of the kids on the head with that paper he's holding. And he hops in the car and he finishes singing ba 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 do ba 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 do ba 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 and drives off. And I was laughing out loud for about a good 5 minutes.
His hand in the air.
Obviously, I butchered the song, but that scene was iconic.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think I was dancing too much at that point to laugh. So I didn't laugh. Okay, Sean, do you have an LOL?
Oh, I do. So Chewie falling for the Ewok trap. Eating, like, you know, he's, that there's that animal just hanging there, and he starts poking at it, and it's just, you can see it coming a mile away, and it just, that just kills me every time.
That's good. That's good. Yeah, he shouldn't have done that. Okay, Roy.
Okay, so I did laugh out loud at this part, and it's in the Young Girls of Rochefort, and it's when Delphine is in the gallery, and the guy's like, there's this beautiful portrait that this promising young artist has drawn, and it looks a lot like you, and then they turn to the picture, and it's like the worst painting you've ever seen in your life. Like, it looks like some kid in like fifth grade or third grade or something, like, turning. It's awful. It's like really awful.
I was watching this with Katie, and I don't think she agreed with me, but I said that several times. I'm like, that painting sucks, right? I mean, that's a crappy painting.
It's a really, really bad painting.
Okay, shoot. I didn't pick that. Okay, I have a few here. You guys, okay, I wrote down a bunch. Spitting in the Mountain Dew, and also the ice cream at Desi's when they're watching the Ellen show. Like, those are some honorable mentions. So I'm not going to – we already mentioned those a bunch of times, so I'm glad those were covered. But the part in Gone Girl where they really reprimand Ben Affleck for not knowing his wife's blood type. Like, you don't know your wife's blood type? Are you serious? You know, and then, like, when after Ben Affleck leaves the room, Fugit was like, should I know my wife's blood type? and it's funny. I mean, like, I don't think I know my blood type. I think it's one of the O's. I'm not even sure. So I don't feel bad about not knowing, you know, my wife's blood type or, you know, not having a wife. But also, I think maybe better than that is in Young Girls of Rochefort when the cafe owner sends two strangers to go pick up her son. And they're like, okay, fine, we'll go pick up your son. And then they go, but someone else, like Delphine, is already there picking up the son. And she's like, are you guys kidnappers? And they say, well, we wouldn't tell you if we were kidnappers. And she's like, yeah, okay, fine, whatever. You know, it's like, okay. Yeah. So I like that. Okay, Roy, best WTH.
Okay, so a couple honorable mentions, both from Gone Girl. Okay. What Amy does to the bottle is pretty bad. Oh. What Nick Dunn having a sleepover at his sister's house while they're looking for his possibly dead wife, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
But the biggest like moment that was like, oh my gosh, it was in the Young Girls of Rochefort, the very first number they sing together where they just immediately in unison look right at the camera. And I felt like they were looking right at me, and it scared me for a second.
So. It's like an ABBA video.
It's like, whoa, whoa. Yeah.
Okay, pretty good. Sean, do you have a WTH?
Yeah, I mean, if we go back to the very first time viewing Gone Girl, when you discover Amy's alive, I mean, that like, when you find out she's still alive, and she... Totally. This whole thing, like I talked about eating the hamburger and saying how happy she realized, and that hits you. For me, that's just like, what the?
That's really good. No, that's I think that's kind of the objective winner. But I didn't pick that. Okay, Tony, what did you pick, though?
I'm going to say that bloody death scene.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of blood, I mean, just the whole setup and just how gruesome that is, and just, yeah, that's a lot.
That's good. All right, my pick is, like, I don't know, what is it, 60 minutes into Young Girls of Rochefort, and it turns out there's, like, this murderer among them? So, that's good.
It's not like just he's walking around shooting people. He cuts them into pieces and sticks them in, like, in trunks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're just like, oh, it was that guy who was at dinner here last night. Oh, well.
And he's out there dancing amongst the people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Tony, best scene.
Okay, can I actually go last? Because mine's more of like my favorite scene. So I want to make sure all the best scenes get covered. Because, I mean, I have a couple honorable mentions that I can give. Right. But I want to go with, like, my favorite scene.
Okay, that's fine. Sean, what do you have?
I went with, again, for me, it was when Nick goes on TV and turns the tables on Amy. Mm. You know, when he's on the, we had talked about this earlier, but that, I mean, there's so many from Return of the Jedi, and but that for me, Nick getting his revenge to go on there, I picked that.
Okay, yeah, I like that scene. Roy?
I'm going to have to go with Luke saves his father and gets to say goodbye to his father.
That's a good scene. Fathers and sons. This is really minor, and it's only like just a few seconds, but for some reason, this is like kind of where the movie turned around, because as I've said before, Return of the Jedi is a very... It's a boring movie. Possibly the boringest movie in space. Well, nah, there are a lot of boring movies in space. But when the fleet, when the Rebel fleet is heading toward the Death Star, and the Millennium Falcon is flying right next to the medical frigate, and it's just the dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, you know, just the dun-dun-dun part of the, you know, of the... What's his name? John Williams... the score, you know, there. It's just like, it's just so pumped up, and it's like, oh my gosh, so much is riding on this, and they're checking in all the red leaders and green leaders and everybody, and it's just like, and they don't know they're going into a trap, but they're going to succeed anyway. So, I don't know. I like that scene. Okay.
Tony.
Okay. I know you already touched on it a little bit in your funniest moment.
Okay.
However, that scene when Nick goes in and is interviewing with the police,
okay.
And the police ask him, you know, what is it that your wife does all day? And he's like, well, I don't know, you know, she's a voracious reader.
Yeah.
And just like, that's the only thing you can come up with, like, you know, she's always got a book in her hand, and then like, I don't know, maybe it's typo, you know, on the blood, and then Boney gets mad at him because he hasn't called his parents-in-law, mm-hmm. And it's just like it almost like sets like the tone for the movie and for Ben Affleck's character, and he's like, well, I couldn't get a signal in the building, you know, and it's just like, he honestly has no idea what to do. He's like not. His character just doesn't get it in those situations, and it just kind of sets the tone for the rest of the movie, which is why I like it, and I get a kick out of all of his answers. So
very good. Do you have honorable mentions on the scene?
Yeah, I actually love the. I love, obviously, just the final battle with Luke, the Emperor, and Vader. Obviously, just, it's iconic.
Love them.
And, you know, you gotta love it.
Yep. Mm. Okay. While you're up, Tony, what do you have for best actor?
Rosamund Pike.
I'm gonna second that.
Really? She absolutely bodies this role. She bodies it.
She's
out
good.
Of the ballpark.
I think she was nominated for an Oscar, I think, for this movie. I think I
she was
that today. Yeah, she is really good. She's not my pick, but she's really, really good. Sean, do you have one?
Yeah, Rosamund Pike.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Very good. I honorable mention to Lola Kirk. I thought she was great as what's her name, Greta, the white trash who steals Rosamund Pike's money.
Yeah.
But I went with Catherine Deneuve. This I feel like it all started right here. And Roy, did you say Rosamund Pike is your actor?
I did. I thought about actually whoever plays their mother, Yvonne. Mm. I thought that actress did a good job, but I agree, Rosamund Pike.
Okay. All right. Roy, what unanswered questions do you have?
Okay. I only have one.
Okay.
It's from Return of the Jedi, when they're on Tatooine, mm-hmm. during the whole free everybody escapade, right? Mm-hmm. So it seems to me like Billy Dee could have just freed everyone from the prison at any time. I mean, because like, when Jabba like sends for Chewbacca and Han, Billy Dee's the one that goes and fetches them. So I think he's got access to the prison. Seems like he just could have broken them out of prison.
Here's another question. If Billy Dee doesn't break them out of prison, what's the point of him just being hanging out in disguise?
Yeah, I don't know.
He's just there, just... All right, but well...
Maybe he's upset when Luke gets there. He's like, dang it, I have this under control. I'm just like... when night falls, I'm just going to break them out of prison. But am I right? Like, couldn't Billy Dee have just broken them out and they all could have left?
Yeah, that's... Yeah, but maybe... You know, he's probably, like, said to Luke, you know, he got to Luke, you know, he went and visited Luke in prison. He's like, okay, Luke, let's go. And then Luke's like, wait, no, this isn't part of the plan. I didn't plan for this. I didn't plan this. I have to get my lightsaber and kill every single one of these mutant Muppet things. okay. Right. Sean, do you have any questions?
Yeah, and I think we can probably all... pretty much get an idea, but still it's worth asking. What kind of life is that child going to have with Nick and Amy? Is there any chance that it grows up with it normal? Is it screwed before birth?
It is screwed. It's like, you know, almost like that's not a human baby. You know, that's just an experiment more than anything, yeah. You know?
Yes.
Well, and chances are that Amy at some point is going to kill Nick, and Amy's going to move on and find another husband.
That's a great point.
Yeah. Maybe that, for the baby's sake, that might be good.
That's actually mine as well. Just what do, like, the next couple years have in store? Like, is Nick able to go hang out with Margot, his twin? Like, you know, she was saying, like...
And fall in love.
Yeah.
I can't be there, you know, for the next 18 years with her. Like, what is, like, life like for Nick and Amy, the baby, you know, just the family from there on out? Like, just what is life like for them? That's...
Does Amy remain friends with the idiot neighbor, or does she just blow her off now?
Well, yeah. I think Amy gains 40 pounds in the next year because she doesn't have to, like, restrain herself anymore.
She doesn't have to say a size 2 anymore. She doesn't care. She just lets it all hang out.
Yeah. Good for Amy. Maybe she'll be more jolly that way. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, I have... Bear with me. I have a few questions here. They're all from Return of the Jedi. First of all... in the Emperor's quarters, Emperor talks to Darth Vader for a minute, and then I think Darth Vader leaves or something, whatever. And then the camera pans over, and there are just those two weirdos hanging out in the Emperor's room. You guys know, like, and like one of them has like weird ears, and they're wearing like weird hats. They kind of look sort of like the Emperor. Who are they? Yeah.
They're like his. Clerics? I don't know, right?
Yeah.
Are they just like acolytes? I don't know.
Yeah,
what
they look like they have some kind of weird religious function, but doesn't say who they are, don't have names, don't have their jobs. You know, I guess they're priests of the Emperor or something. Okay. Okay. When Lando Calrissian beams into the Death Star, and, you know, and the Unnub says, hey, the Empire's jamming us. And then Lando Calrissian says, wait, how can they be jamming us if they don't know we're coming? And then he realizes the shield is still up, even though no one else has any reading on the shield. So then they break away from the shield, right? And then they have a huge space battle. 20 minutes later, the rebel forces on the ground destroy the moon base thing, and then Lando Calrissian says, hey, the shield is down. How did he know the shield was down if they didn't get any reading on whether the shield was up from the first time?
He felt it with the Force.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. Fine, I'll take that answer. Okay, my last question, Return of the Jedi, is, you know, that poor schlub who's constructing the new Death Star, which apparently is 480% bigger than the first Death Star, and it has the huge chunks in it that are missing... You know? Yep. But the Death Star, it's fully operational, right? So why doesn't he just take giant swaths of plaster to just the open Death Star areas.
Just spackle over it?
Spackle over the entire Death Star, yeah. Because it works, right? They don't need those parts to make it work.
I don't know. Maybe that's like the food court. I don't know.
No, it could be the food court. Okay, those are all my questions. Thank you for answering them all so fully. Tony, best line of these.
Okay, this is from the Young Girls of Rochefort. Okay. Sailors give us a better time than all you carnies combined.
Oh, that's a great line.
Yeah.
I like it. I like it a lot.
And then just an honorable mention to that, when Tanner Bolt or Tyler Perry shows up and he says, Elvis is in Missouri. Love that. But yeah. Sailors give us a better time than all you carnies combined.
That's a good line. All right, Sean, do you have one?
It's a trap.
That's a good line. Very
nice.
Okay, Roy?
Sure, I'm going to go with, I've got to save you. You already have, Luke. You were right about me. Tell your sister you were right.
Oh, my gosh. I hate you. That was my line. You already have. You were right. You were right about me. Tell your sister you were right. I can't believe you picked that line. All right, Roy. All right. Let's best tagline. What do you have for best tagline of these posters that you picked out?
Yeah, sure. As long as you don't forget to do best Odyssey reference at some point.
I'm not going to forget.
Okay. My favorite tagline is continues 86 degrees. I think that's something I read on one of the posters.
Continues. Like, I think that's on the Gone Girl poster, but I think it's like part of the background that, like.
Do any of these posters even have taglines?
Continues 86 degrees.
Yeah, it says something. I think it's like a police thing or something that continues 86. That's fine. It's on the poster. That's fine. I'll just skip to my pick. In Return of the Jedi, it says just kind of in small letters above Return of the Jedi, Star Wars, which I felt was a very good tag because there are a lot of stars and wars in Return of the Jedi. So that's a good tagline.
Star Wars.
Yeah. Tony, I assume you didn't find a tagline on the posters.
I did not find taglines on the posters.
Fair enough.
I didn't either.
Okay, that's... Yeah.
I guess we could go with widescreen for one of them.
Right, yeah. I thought about Color by Deluxe for...
Color by Deluxe.
Yeah, that's fine. Okay, so it's Color a bad set of taglines. Fortunately, we get to make up our taglines. Roy, go ahead with your taglines.
Sure, the Young Girls of Rochefort. Murder, stabbing, dancing. Return of that's the good. Jedi. Only a Jedi can kill his father and marry his sister. Gone Girl from the acclaimed director of Straight Up. We don't have to take our clothes off and bop till you drop.
And also the Love is Strong Rolling Stones video.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Okay, Sean, do you have taglines?
I do. Okay. We've got Rochefort, France, dance, and pastel pants.
Oh, ooh. I love it.
Jedi, beware of the lair.
Oh.
And Gone Girl, always have an exit strategy.
Ah, very good.
That's good. That's good. Okay. All right. Tony.
Yes, for the girls of Rochefort, for love and the art of the dance.
Nice.
And then for... Return of the Jedi, I just put the dark side awaits.
Ooh.
That's all right. Good. Yeah.
You know, because they, you know, and then Gone Girl, I like having nothing just because I you don't want to give the movie away. And it's just like, I feel like anything that you say could give the movie away. I know I wasn't fun with that, but.
So you put all of that on the poster?
That's a lot. Yeah.
Just the guy at the poster factory is like, I'm not giving this away. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like it. Okay. For my taglines, okay, for Young Girls of Rochefort, I have doble frais, doble lisse, doble délicieux, à mouchard, un doble plaisir, vox attend, doble mincum.
That equates to?
It equates to double fresh, double smooth, double delicious to chew. A double pleasure is waiting for you, double mint gum.
Hey.
All right. My Jedi tagline is, the middle trilogy concludes. And even though it's the middle trilogy, trust us, it's the only good one. And it concludes. Okay. And my gone girl is, you go, girl. You go, girl, gone. Do you have a titular line?
So I just created one.
Okay.
Because I don't think there was in it, there wasn't one from any of these.
Yeah, I don't think it is.
There wasn't an instance, so I just created one. Mm-hmm. And you pretty much took it with the with your alt tagline, but I just wrote, man, she is gone, girl.
Nice. Okay, Sean?
Yeah, I didn't have one. I couldn't nobody said it and I didn't get one.
Yeah. My favorite one is I guess that would be a Star Wars one. Yeah, never mind. When will they stop these Star Wars? That's like one of my favorite.
Yeah.
That's okay, but yeah, I mean, you could just say, "Hey, it's the Return of the Jedi," when Han says that to Luke when he walks back to Endor. But you're not using that. Okay, Roy, what do you have?
Okay, I forgot to do this word, but I just got it. So, from the Young Girls of Rochefort, I've got, "Hey, we're carnies, and we need to know where to find the Young Girls of Rochefort."
Oh, that's perfect.
We need to find
the Young Girls. Okay, I picked, when Greta stole Amy's money in Gone Girl, she says, "Yeah, we need it, so sorry, your money is gone. Girl, you gotta get yourself a bank account."
Wait, did you make that up?
No, that was in the movie, wasn't it?
She actually said that?
No, she didn't.
Those two lines were back to back?
No, she didn't say that. I made that up. I made it up. Okay. I can't.
All right.
Yeah, I made it up.
Best Odyssey reference is Amy is definitely Circe.
Oh, really? I did Amy Takes a Road Trip at one point.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Okay. Sean, do you have an Odyssey reference?
Yeah, I did Amy Takes the Road Trip.
Nice. Huh? Tony?
I think I'm doing this right, but I did Homecoming.
Very good.
Yes. Okay, yeah, there was Homecoming. All right. Okay, Twin Awards. Who had the best twins power, Sean?
Oh, that's got to be the Force.
Yeah, I agree. Luke and Leia had the Force. So
Luke and Leia with the Force. Yeah.
Okay, Tony, do you have the best twin superpower?
I'm going to go with the singing voices from the two young girls of Rochefort.
That's a good answer. That's super good. Okay, Roy.
Because does Leia even have the Force? I know she has the Mary Poppins float in space, but I don't think she really has the Force.
Well, Yoda kind of says she's like the last hope, and you know, and Luke says, if I don't come back, then you have to replace me in this. So I think she at least has potential, even though she hasn't had any training. I think she has the Force because she somehow remembers her mother that she killed in childbirth.
And she senses that Luke got off the Death Star.
Luke got off the Death Star. That's true. Even though it seems kind of more like a pretentious thing that she says to bug Han in that moment. So
I know he got off, and I can't wait till he gets back.
I still like those singing voices.
So I'm with Tony. I went with a little different, but I went with shimmy dance powers that captivates the entire town of Rochefort.
That's good.
Yes, the Asian shimmy that they learned on the fly.
That's right.
They just get out there and do it.
Nice. Roy, best twincest.
Okay. So, Okay, so I think the most possible twincest was Luke and Leia because they didn't find out until late in the game, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And I don't think there was really any chance of the two young girls from Rochefort twincesting with each other. Mm-hmm. But I went with Nick and Margot. I think they'd make a good couple. So there you go.
Yeah, I kind of feel they're the only ones who kind of like each other, so it makes sense. Okay, Tony, do you have best twincest?
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. Except, obviously, I just went with Luke and Leia because, I mean, they got extremely close.
Yeah,
if it wasn't for Han stepping in with saying the "I know," then yeah. And I want to say every time I hear Han saying "I know," I think about Tommy Lee Jones saying "I don't care" from The Fugitive, and so Leia saying "I love you," and then Tommy Lee Jones "I don't care."
That's good. That's a good mashup. Let's see. Did everybody say their twincest?
Mine's the same. It's implied. It gets implied in that moment from that woman on TV, you know, saying, "Look how close these two twins are." And then, of course, it gets said in the movie. That guy leans over at the airport. Twincest. So yes. It's got to
yeah.
Nick and Margot.
That may have been the introduction of the term twincest, because I think this probably happened before Game of Thrones, like message boards when people talk about twincest.
So, yeah.
I'm actually going to go with the two Rochefort girls. I don't know if this movie passes the Bechdel test, because pretty much every conversation the Rochefort girls have is of love and... and so I almost feel like that qualifies, because their relationship is based on them getting men, and that kind of it's almost like everything they talk about is sex anyway, you know. So who knows? They probably at least practice kissing on each other, maybe. So,
all right, John.
Sean, who were the most believable twins?
I went with Luke and Leia.
Oh, okay. Nice.
I went with Luke and Leia, just the whole family ties, the whole background of it all. I felt like that they, in the end, were the most believable. And, strangely enough, I felt like they looked the most alike. I guess you don't have to be identical, but still, that's where I went.
That is very strange, actually, for reasons we'll get into. Tony, do you have who are the best, most believable twins?
I'm going with Nick and Go.
Yeah.
I mean, they had like a... They at least had a sibling relationship rather than a sexual relationship.
Luke and Leia. Sibling-y, yeah.
Yeah, their relationship felt pretty genuine.
Is that who you picked, Roy?
It's not. I went with Solange and Delphine because, as you had previously mentioned,
they are
actually sisters.
Yeah. Which is weird because they look very different to me. Like, very different. I kind of thought that to myself. I'm like, who would believe that these two people are sisters? Because I didn't believe it. And then it turns out they literally are. So for that reason, I did not pick them. I went with Nick and Go, even though, I don't know, I guess it's the power of acting. They have the biggest age gap. I think they're 10 years apart, like the actors are in real life. And
oh, wow.
I think Mark Hamill and Princess Leia are, I think, like 4 years apart. And then the young girls of Rochefort are like 18 months apart. But acting, I don't know. Okay, those are the twin awards. Any other awards that I missed?
Well, you had best twins, and I put Luke and Leia because together they defeated the Empire.
I'm gonna go with the Rochefort girls because they enraptured me in my heart and the world's heart and France's heart.
And France's, I have them as the weirdest twins. They're kind of weird. They're a little weird.
Okay. I have Luke and Leia are probably pretty weird. I might mind that. Okay. Cortezes, who do you have for best twins and weirdest twins?
I got best twins as Nick and Go, because Go is going to mortgage her house and give up her savings and everything just to save Nick's useless butt. And so they've united on that front. And weirdest twins, I went with Rochefort only because of that. The very thing that just got brought up is, you know, they fooled around with each other. They probably weren't as confident in themselves and you know, had to practice kissing and all the, you know, swapping clothes, the odd things. And damn, they're French. Come on.
Yeah. So many slumber parties happening.
Yeah. Like,
pillow fights.
I've got weirdest Luke and Leia because, I mean, that relationship's just weird. And best is Nick and Amy. Yeah. No. Yeah. Nick and Go.
Yeah. All right. Good sets. I think these were some strong twins. Strong twins that we picked. So nice work, everybody, on the picks. And now we go for something I feel truly arbitrary, because I think it's ridiculous to name any of these movies above or below any of the other. I mean, talk about apples and oranges. I'd rather compare apples and oranges. But nevertheless, I'm curious what you guys think. Sean, what is your third favorite movie of these?
I went Rochefort.
I went Rochefort as well.
I thought you guys might pick Rochefort. Roy, were you captured by the Frenchness of it, or do you like the force, or do you like murder and deceit?
You mean which one do I like the least?
Which one do you like the least?
Which one do I hate the most?
You hate? Yeah. Which one do you hate?
Like you said, John, they're all different, and so my number three was delightful, but it's my number three, The Young Girls of Rochefort.
Young Girls of Rochefort. Yeah, I knew. This is Red Shoes all over again.
Gosh, about Red Shoes when I told him that this was what we had coming.
More
shoes.
Red Shoes is a fantastic movie, as is The Young Girls of Rochefort. I'm gonna go Gone Girl is my number three. My number two, you know what, I'm going Return of the Jedi for my number two. I love it so much. I love how it ends so much, but I have to mark it as my number two because even though it's one of my favorite movies ever, the Jabba's Palace sequence is the worst. I hate it so much, so very much.
And also, I mean, there's not that many scenes in Return of the Jedi where they're dancing and singing in French.
No.
No.
Not enough. Hardly any.
Yeah.
Okay, if we're coming back around, my number two is Gone Girl.
Nice. Okay. All right. Let's see. Tony, over to you. Who's your number two?
I'll just tell you right now, both Cortezes have Jedi at number two.
Okay. A united front in favor of the evil movie Gone Girl that left me dark and disturbed, and I loved it. It's a really good movie. It's a good movie.
Okay, we're all over the place. So coming back to me, Return of the Jedi, obviously, and then John... You love your French musical.
I'll take the French musical. I think it was, okay. You know what? I really liked it a lot, but I think I kind of the biggest reason I'm picking it as number one is because it's a movie I haven't seen a bunch of times already. I think I'm kind of going with that because it's like, oh, I'm so glad I finally saw this. You know, because it's like one that would be like, oh yeah, this will be fun, and it's why I like doing the podcast. So I like doing these new ones. So.
Hey, 98% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, and it made a whopping $98,000 at the theater.
Nice. Wow. They paid $1,000 to each critic.
I'm already dark and disturbed, so I feel like that's where I come out of.
Yeah.
Hey, Gone Girl made $370 million. That's a lot of money.
It's a lot. It was big. Where were you that summer when everyone was watching Gone Girl, Roy?
2014. Where would I have been? Monterey, California.
Ah. Oh, dang it. Yeah, it could have been when I came over to watch. Oh, wait.
Star Trek.
Yeah, well, that was way back in 2009.
I would have
Star Trek in Monterey. That's
right. I would have thought you were on a bus to Paris.
So I will say I've been to Paris a couple times, and no one has been singing or dancing.
Because you went to Paris and not Rochefort.
Yeah, that's true. That was my mistake. But I did have a lovely time. And if I ever go back, I'm going to go back in a bright yellow outfit, and I'll do my own singing and dancing, I guess.
That'll be lovely. I like that. Yeah. Okay. Well, that wraps up the Twin podcast aspect. I think, is it time for future business?
It's time.
Okay. We'll get Zoe on the phone right now because it's Halloween, but we're not really getting Zoe on the phone because we actually pre-recorded our conversation with Zoe. So we're going to go ahead for the next 3 weeks. Is it the next 3 weeks right in a row?
Yeah, starting a week from Thursday. So the 7th, the 14th, and the 21st, yeah.
Oh my gosh, it's going to be crazy. Okay, so for the next 3 weeks, we're doing our Halloween series. And so next week it's three movies taking place in the 19th century. The week after that it's Little Scene Creature Features, and then the week after that it's Dario Argento movies. So I'm going to hit play on this button right now. Okay, hey, this is the pre-recorded portion. We're going to reveal to each other our picks, and we're going to try to act surprised because this is pre-recorded, even though I literally don't know what anybody else is going to pick for their Halloween things. Okay, right. So next week, like in a week, in a very short amount of time, and if you're listening to the podcast in like 2 days because I posted this, you know, so late, next week we're starting our Halloween movies, and so we're going to pick next week's three movies with Zoe, and then we're going to, right after that, we're going to pick the following week's three movies with Zoe, which will happen the week immediately after that. Because it's Halloween and the pressure's on, right? Okay, so, Zoe, say hello.
Hello, hello.
All right.
Happy to be here.
Nice. Okay, glad you're on the call. And what is this? Is this 4 years in a row that we've done the Halloween thing?
I think so, yes.
Yeah,
is the fourth year. Okay, cool. So, the first category, let's just get this down. The first category, checking notes, is 19th century scary horror movies. 19th century Halloween movies, right? Dumb category.
Yeah, so,
dumb category. So, I don't know who picked this.
You picked it to lose, right?
I picked it to lose, and it won, but whatever. So now we're going to do it.
We should clarify that that doesn't mean movies made in the 19th century. We're not talking about The Birth of a Nation, right? So, or whatever movie might have been made right before 1900. But this is movies.
I think 15 years too late. Go.
Am I off? I'm way off, aren't I? It's got to be movies where the setting is the 19th century.
Setting is the 19th century. And I kind of want – I didn't say this before, but I want to disqualify time travel movies, but maybe it's too late to say that now.
It's not too late for me. I'm right. Time travel's for babies. Okay, you ready?
Ho, 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 sh!
I'm first. You ready?
You're first. Okay. Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, so Universal has done a bunch of reboots, and they all suck. Because they don't like honor the material, right? They try to make them into stupid things like Tom Cruise's The Mummy,
so
right?
We're not watching that one.
We're not watching it. They're all awful. Or Dracula Untold,
and
right?
All which was also 20th century, aren't they?
Some of them, but this one is not.
Okay.
So 2010, the critics hated it, but I approve of it. Guillermo del Toro's The Wolfman. Yeah, or is it Benicio? It's one of the del Toros.
Benicio del Toro stars in it.
Yeah.
I don't think Guillermo del Toro directed it. Zoe, you love that movie. Who directed it?
Joe Johnson directed it.
The
guy who directed like The Rocketeer?
The Rocketeer.
Oh, yeah. Very nice. So, okay.
I remember being pleasantly surprised, and I think it's pretty violent, which I think that like if you're going to reboot these horror movies, try to make them a horror movie, right? And so I think this one really is an earnest effort to do that. And so I've only seen it once, but that's what we're doing.
Okay. That sounds good. I thought about picking that one, honestly. I thought there would be absolutely no room for overlap in this category, but I considered that one because I'm like, well, maybe that would work.
So I had another pick that makes me so sad I didn't choose it, but there's another category it fits into that I'm really eager to do maybe next year. But anyway, Zoe, I think you're next.
Good. I am going with a Hammer picture, and that is The Curse of Frankenstein.
Wow. Okay.
The Curse of Frankenstein.
The Curse of Frankenstein.
It's available on HBO Max.
Hot dang! I know someone who's got that.
You're welcome. Okay. Curse of Frankenstein, Hammer. Okay, good. I'm glad we got Hammer in.
Terrence Fisher, my favorite Hammer director, Terrence Fisher. I've actually never seen it, but I will have a digital copy because I own it digitally. So if there is not a membership to HBO Max and it is needed, I can send it out.
There is. So John, you can do the right thing here and create symmetry by choosing a Dracula movie, but whatever.
I was just going to say, funny you should mention that, because I was thinking how unusual that was, because I did not mean to. Out of the five movies I considered, two of them are, well, not Dracula movies, but vampire movies. So I am going a vampire movie, and it is 18th century, and I don't know if it's necessarily Dracula, but it's, oh, sorry, did I say 18th century? I meant 19th century. It is 19th century. I'm going to go with Roman Polanski's Fearless Vampire Killers.
Vampire Killers. Okay. Oh, my gosh, we got a werewolf, a Frankenstein monster, yep, and a vampire movie. I'm so happy.
Yeah. I almost picked the Lizzie Borden movie with Kristen Stewart, but I decided against it. That's on Shudder.
So I thought about From Hell. I thought it would be interesting to do From Hell. Do you consider that a horror movie? That was on my short list.
I was very, very close to picking Elvira's Haunted Hills, which apparently takes place in the 1800s.
Nice.
Okay. All right. Well, okay, so awesome. So that's for next week. That's great. Wolfman, The Curse of Frankenstein, Fearless Vampire Killers.
That's a good
group. So okay. What's our next category for the week following? Right. We're giving you guys a heads up, so
yeah,
you know.
The heads up. The next category is another category I disagree with, and I am picking my vote under protest, but that's fine. But this is Zoe's category, and it's what word did you use? Underseen creature features or
yes.
Underrated? Underseen.
Yep. Underseen.
Okay. Well, I'm going to define underseen in my own way, in that I haven't seen it, so that's my pick anyway. And I don't know if a lot of people have seen my movie, but Roy, what's the order? Am I first in this one?
You're first, sir.
Okay. We're heading to the Outback. We're heading to Australia, and we're heading to the creature, and the creature is a giant pig, I believe. We're watching Razorback.
Oh,
yes!
Razorback. That's great.
Oh, my gosh. That is so glorious. Oh, I love it.
Okay. So I feel like, Zoe, I honored your category here, and I've been dying to go to do a movie. We've done one movie with this actor before, and I've been dying to return. And so we are going to see Santo and the Blue Demon versus the Monsters.
Oh. Santo the Wrestler?
Yep. and his tag team partner, the Blue Demon, apparently.
Demon. Yeah. So it's like, it's not Santo... Oh, wow, it sounds like Santo fights the Blue Demon. But no, he's fighting monsters. They both are teaming up to fight other things.
That's right.
Okay.
So funny.
And it is available. I checked. It's
Is it available only in Spanish again, like that one the other time
I
watched the Santo movie?
I desperately hope it's only in Spanish with no subtitles yet. So, all right, Zoe, what do you got?
That leaves me. The movie is Equinox, and it's from 1970. It's actually a Criterion release, so I'm very interested in seeing it. That's how I own it, is Criterion. But again, I will have this digitally, so I'm happy to share.
So the monster is Autumn?
Nailed it.
Okay. 1970, huh? Okay.
That's awesome.
Criterion? Okay, I have no idea what it is. So, what year was Santo and the Blue Demon and the other things?
Oh, let me see. Santo. Let's see. Santo and the Blue Demon versus the Monsters, 1970. So,
oh.
two 1970 films. Okay. What's what else do we need a date for? The Curse of Frankenstein.
57.
Oh, well, there you go.
Been late. Okay, so the order. So the order of watching these, we watched The Curse of Frankenstein, and then The Fearless Vampire Killers, and then The Wolfman, and then...
What year is what year is Fearless Vampire Killers?
1967.
Okay.
I apologize.
And then I'm guessing Equinox, and then Santo, and the Blue Demons versus the Monsters, and then Razorback.
Razorback? I'm so excited.
And then when we do our recording with the 19th century recording, then we're going to pick our movies for Dario Argento movies.
Yes, 1970, early 80 Dario Argento movies.
Yeah.
I can't wait to pick Asya's chest movies in the 2000s, just garbage town.
It was not stipulated in the original poll that there had to be 1970s, 80s. So I could pull a spite vote for late era Argento. It is Halloween after all, and you know, we need a few surprises. But well, we'll see how big my desire is to do that. Okay.
Right.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, the season started. I guess we're going to be really busy.
Yay!
All right. So.
Zoe, you're already watching, what, like 140 movies in the next month or something? So nine more is a drop in the bucket.
Nine more is a drop in the bucket. Yeah, I'm actually really excited. Throw it on the list. It'll be good. Yeah, I've got, I think I'm in like 69 or 70 movies already. And I've got
about
50 with these additional six. I've got, like 50... 7 or 58 or somewhere to go. So, yeah. Mucho. I didn't think I was going to beat my 111 from last year, but I'm going to this year. So, I'm excited.
That's awesome. Good for you, Zoe.
Yep.
Yeah. So, my wife, I think, she's currently limited me to, like, one movie a week or something. I don't know. So, I'm proud of you for... I live vicariously through your 7 Halloween movies per day diet right now, so...
Yeah, I got to listen. The wife's on board, so it's easier for me to do it at night. So I mean, terrible stuff too. I mean, just if you guys have Shudder, watch the Elvira Messiah of Evil. I'm not even kidding you. It's the most bonkers WTF movie of all time, but it's got the best gas station set I've ever seen.
Wow!
Ooh.
Wow!
Anyway,
really reaching
it's like,
there.
Gas station in 4K. It's like the most gorgeous thing I've ever seen. I think Beside People was like 1973 or something. Anyway, crazy movie. It's nuts.
Well, we're going to have to add a new category for our awards for best gas station scene.
Yeah.
All right.
Ooh.
All right. Well, gents, I can't wait. It's going to be so much fun.
Yeah.
Be good. Okay. Yes. Okay. Thanks for the pre-record. Everybody, I guess Zoe, get watching on these. Cram these into your 70 other movies.
Done.
I'll find the time here. Boy, I it's Halloween's here, and I'm stressed out. So let's go do this thing.
All right.
This is not recorded live.
Okay, see you guys.
Yeah, we're coming back. So Sean and Tony, I don't know if you guys watch the movies that when you're not a part of the podcast, but we're pretty excited. So just to recap what you already heard from our live conversation with Zoe, next week we are watching movies take place in the 19th century. We're watching Benicio del Toro's The Wolfman.
Yes.
Ooh.
We're
yes.
watching The Curse of Frankenstein, a Hammer film from 1957. And then John chose Fearless Vampire Killers from, is that Roman Polanski?
It's Roman Polanski and what's her name? Sharon Tate before her demise. Yeah.
Wow.
Fearless Vampire Killers, 1967. Yep.
What a lineup.
It'll be good. Pretty, Yeah.
And then the week after that, what are we watching?
Okay, the week after that, we're doing Creature Features, and we're watching Equinox from 1970. I think there's a lot of like stop motion animation in that. And Santo and the Blue Demon against the Monsters, the Mexican wrestler movie from 1970.
I'm so excited.
Yeah. And then also the Australian wild pig movie, Razorback.
Oh, wowie.
Yeah. Have you guys seen any of these movies?
No, I've never seen any of those.
I've seen the Benicio del Toro Wolfman.
Yeah. Wolfman, of course.
Okay, yeah. I actually missed Wolfman. It seems like everybody really likes the Benicio del Toro Wolfman that I've talked to, yeah.
The critics dumped on it, but I loved it.
Yeah, I loved it.
Oh, nice.
So, okay. So just real quick on the Wolfman, there was an original director that was supposed to be directing it, and I can't remember what his name is, and it was struggling, so they had to bring in a new director, and they brought in a guy named Joe Johnston, and they told him if he came in to fix the Wolfman, then he could direct
Captain America?
I believe it was Captain America, yes.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Oh, I had never heard that. That's interesting. You know, a lot of people didn't really like the first Captain America. I thought the first Captain America was really cool because it was like a... It kind of felt like a World War II comic book kind of thing. You know, like a comic book you would read in World War II sort of thing. I liked Captain America. And I like the Rocketeer, too, so that's good. Okay, well, anyway, that's what's coming up. And then next week we're going to reveal the third week of Halloween movies. We haven't picked them yet, but they're going to be Dario Argento movies. So we'll get to those later. But in the meantime,
yay, hey, it's Halloween thank time. You, Cortese Brothers, for making that happen.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, did you guys vote for the Dario Argento movies in the thing?
At least
I did. I saved you guys from the Halloween comedies.
Oh, I wanted the Halloween comedies.
It would have been good. I think because if that had been chosen, I would have been really tempted to pick Tucker and Dale versus Evil, which I think is really funny.
It's good. Yeah. But that's fine.
What about that most recent Adam Sandler movie?
Hubie Halloween.
That would have been a must watch.
Would have been good. Oh well, that's fine.
Or What We Do in the Shadows would have been a lot of fun.
Yeah, surprisingly, right. We haven't done What We Do in the Shadows yet. So, okay, well, but anyway, that's coming up. I guess we don't have anything else to talk about. Do you guys have anything else to talk about?
No, I think we've covered it from Rochefort all the way to the outer galaxies.
Yes. This is like we've spanned so much. So. Thank you guys for your patience and the whiplashness of the topic and your twin knowledge. And you know, when we make a movie of this podcast, the Yours, Mine, and Theirs movie, you guys can come on and play twins, even though you're not actually twins from my understanding.
It's only a 3-year age difference, so it's like Luke and Leia.
Yeah, it's like Luke and Leia.
Yeah, it's pretty much, yeah.
It's totally like that. Let's go ahead and wrap things up. I'm going to say this first while I remember it. If you guys don't contact us on the internet, that's fine. You can contact us on phone. Call us at 801-896-4542. 801-896-4542. You can totally leave a message. You can tell us we were wrong, and we'll play it because we deserve it. But you deserve to be heard. It's a free country. So go ahead and do it that way. Email us at yoursmindtheirspodcast@gmail.com. Go to our blog at yoursmindtheirspodcast.blogspot.com. That way you can download all of our MP3s directly, going way back to that very first episode where we talked about John Carpenter's The Thing and Howard Hawks' The Thing and True Grit, I think, and some other movies. Anyway, it's a long time ago. I think The Fly was in there. Anyway, it was really good. It was super awesome. And go to iTunes, go to Apple Podcasts, go to Stitcher,
go to Spotify? We're probably not on Spotify. Anyway, wherever you get your podcasts, go ahead and go to the place where you get them and leave us 5 stars or whatever equivalent and give us a comment, whatever. That would mean so much to us. So,
Or you can also call us at 1-800-AMY4TIPS.
Yes.
I'm sure that number works, and yeah, we can be reached there.
Yeah, we'll go ahead and call that number. Yeah. Perfect. Thank you for that. Okay. But that's all I have to say. So I've said it all. Cortezes, you've been great. You've been patient. You've been wonderful. I've already said that before. So probably sometime next year, come back. We'll talk some more stuff.
We'll definitely be back, and we are again honored that you would have us on. And this was so fun; we loved it. And we'll be commenting on the page and sending you guys stuff that will disturb you, warm your heart, and all in between, as this podcast was.
Okay,
thank you so much.
Yep,
do that. Manipulate.
Let's keep talking. Find me on Letterboxd, and yep.
Oh yeah, Tony. Who are you? What's your name on Letterboxd?
I'm A.K. Cortesi.
A.K. Cortesi. Okay, everybody go ahead and find that. I think normally I'll try it. Let me put that in the show notes. Usually, like, in the show notes, it has mine and Roy's letterbox list in there. So, okay, we'll stick that in for this time. And, yeah, thanks again, you guys. Roy, anything else to say?
Nope. Just like you said, thank you, you guys. These were two really, really fun podcasts. I had a blast with the movies, and we had a great time talking with you guys about them.
Totally. Okay. And with that, we're going to go watch some scary movies. So everybody join us for the scary movies. If you don't join us, then I guess you're just going to have to listen to us talk about it so you don't have to watch the movies. If that's how you do it, then I don't know. But anyway, it's Halloween. Okay, so we'll
happy be back Halloween. For that.
Yeah. I'm going to hit play on this button right now, and Zoe and the rest of us are going to reveal the first 2 weeks worth of movies. Can you guys hear that?
Okay. Are you actually pressing play?
No, I'm not.
Okay, good. Thank heavens. Yeah. I didn't want to sit here through that, so...